Mrs. Palmer, I'm Mr. Hartley's executive director. I allocate the funds when and where I want.
Then perhaps you won't mind my talking to him.
Talk all you like.
If I say you're a liar, he'll know who to believe.
Don't be too sure, Mr. Sawyer. There's something about the truth that gets through to people. I shall tell him everything you told me to say, step by step. You'll see.
Mrs. Palmer, I wouldn't give you 5 cents. You'd be back every day with your hand out.
I only need what is due to me.
Forget it, Mrs. Palmer, and if I were you, I'd leave town. The police want a license for sideshows.
Police. I'll tell them a few things.
Talk all you like. I'm asking you to talk. Talk your head off.
I'm not a sideshow freak, Mr. Sawyer. There's more to it than you think.
Are you going to put a curse on me?
There's no need. You have a curse on you. You want to take over. To run everybody and everything. You want power, but you're not big enough. So you steal it, piece by piece. But it's tainted, Mr. Sawyer. Tainted and spoiled. And you'll weaken. You'll sicken. Step by step, you'll weaken and the power will leave you.
Thank you, Mrs. Palmer. That'll be all.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 17th of June, 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with this military-grade Ukraine psychological warfare, and also, of course, that COVID medical misinformation, where an estimated 60,000 Brits have died unnecessarily because ivermectin apparently is a conspiracy theory and not a treatment for COVID, which could have saved 60,000 lives. The London media lies, now all forgotten apparently. The transmitter and printing press owners hell-bent on turning society into a hostile environment for readers, listeners, viewers, and particularly gypsies. Anyway, joining me to discuss the Fourth Reich Matrix, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week, looking at the Illuminati. This is Britain's Illuminati, or the Order of the Garter, the coverage of it being rather thin. But fascinating anyway to see Garter Day, very much like our own Charter Day with the Merchant Venturers here in Bristol. This is about the great and the good, who we're supposed to just think are just there to do wear funny costumes and be knights. But actually, this is the oldest order of chivalry in the world, the Order of the Garter. And a couple of great people have just been initiated into it. What happens is they tend to die off, the elderly ones, so they've got to fill the vacancies every year. And Camilla is one of them, or Carmilla, as I prefer to call her. And, of course, now Sir Tony Blair. Wonderful, isn't it? But anyway, the coverage is pretty thin. We're going to be doing a lot more detail. Julian Assange, Priti Patel, signed the piece of paper saying he can go to the United States, but as much of Priti Patel's work, it could come to nothing. Let's hope so, and we'll be talking about that too. Next week, a series of rail strikes right across Britain by the Rail Maritime Transport Union. We hear an exclusive interview with a former Deputy General Secretary of the RMT, which is about, amongst other things, what this strike is actually really about and why it matters, which is something that we're not getting from the London media. All they seem to want to talk about is how much it's going to disrupt the country, not what the purpose of it is. Martin, let's just kick off by looking at this Julian Assange case, which I think is really the kind of the top news of the week, really. What's going on with Julian? Why does it matter, this Julian Assange extradition?
Well, I think it's a very politically significant case, in that there isn't really any legal case to answer here, in my view. And it's a way of intimidating genuine journalists all over the world. They're basically saying that anybody anywhere in the world can be charged with espionage against the United States of America under the 1917 Espionage Act, and they can be extradited to life imprisonment or worse in the United States. So it's a massive legal power grab by the US deep state. and the British have basically cooperated with it in every way.
We've bent over backwards for them, haven't we?
Indeed.
Peter O'Bourne's got an article in the Guardian website, I guess in tomorrow's Guardian, saying Britain has approved Assange's extradition. War criminals and murderers rejoice. Priti Patel's decision to hand over the WikiLeaks co-founder shows the price of investigative journalism anywhere the US holds sway, and that's obviously here in Britain. Why does the US have so much power here, Martin? It seems that this decision is a one made in Washington, nothing to do with London, and Boris has just completely bent over for them.
Well, the 1917 Espionage Act was originally an internal act of repression against those who opposed the US entry into the First World War, like Eugene Debs, who was sent to prison, or Bill Hayward, who fled to the Soviet Union, who was the leader of the industrial workers of the world. But in the 1960s, it always remained on the statute books. And in the 1960s, Congress passed a law that it had extraterritorial jurisdiction. So anybody, anywhere in the world, could be charged with treason against the United States.
So what is it the United States have got against Assange? What are they afraid of?
Well, what he did is he exposed... I think the main thing when they really decided they were going to, you know, he's already in their sights. They're also openly discussed assassinating him, of course. And they interfered with his legal team. And there's already a legal case led by Balthazar Garzon in Spain to indict the US authorities for doing
this. This reminds me very much of what Michael Hudson was talking about, the last days of Rome, where they started to assassinate their critics.
Well, I mean, the Roman Empire was pretty. They assassinated people quite a lot. It didn't degenerate, and then they started assassinating people. It is very like the Roman Empire in that they feel they have the right to tell the world what to do, and they've got themselves into the frame of mind where anybody who doesn't agree with them is clearly an enemy and has to be treated as such, which of course is hubris. They can bully Assange. But, of course, ultimately, they're going to find that nobody will do business with them.
That's right. Well, the message goes out around the world that this is the place where the evil people are. This is a place where the truth cannot be told, because the people who are misusing their power are doing it in such an appalling manner. Murderers, torturers and war criminals will be toasting the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, tonight. Her decision to approve the extradition of Julian Assange turns investigative journalism into a criminal act, continues Peter O'Bourne, and licenses the US to mercilessly hunt down offenders wherever they can be found, bringing them to justice and punishing them with maximum severity. So this is now a criminal act, investigative journalism.
Yeah.
And it's what we do every week, of course.
That's right. So we, in theory, once the precedent is established, they can then go after anybody they want. And, of course, if we do have a major war, and it looks like we might, then maybe they will just round up everybody they don't like. That's what it looks like, doesn't it?
Well, before we carry on looking at Julian's case, then there is also something that sound engineer Dave Basenko shared with me earlier, which is Alina Lipp, the new White Rose of Germany. Independent journalists may face 3 years behind bars for speaking the truth. This is starting to get a bit of a habit, isn't it? The rulers of the NATO countries have decided that anybody that embarrasses them or says something that they don't agree with should be thrown to the lions. The ideal democracy of the West, the freedom of speech, is all starting to crumble, like it did not so long before, this article says on Stanislavs.org. The independent German journalist Anna Lipp, of whom I wrote a few occasions before, the trickle of truth from Donbass, thanks to more international independent journalists, the independent journalists and resources in Donbass, with future updates. She may face 3 years behind bars for giving the voice of the people of the Donbass, for going to that part of the world and doing what any real journalist does, talk to the locals, watch events and relay that to the world at large. So the German government is fighting against freedom of speech. I'm a free journalist, she says, who covers the special operation in Ukraine. They're going to sentence me now to 3 years in prison for telling the truth in absentia. According to current German law, it's only allowed to publish one-sided information that benefits the authorities. Anything that goes against this unwritten law is punished by the biased judicial machine. But the independent blogging community is ready to resist censorship in the West. As she says, I continue to work in Donetsk. If you are interested in the special project I mentioned, email me at wombator, WOMBATOR 2022 mail.ru. Her channel, which I think I'm right in saying is a Telegram channel, is Neues aus Russland, and it is in German, I think. Neues, N-E-U-E-S, aus R-U-S-S-L-A-N-D. But at least she's still able to ply her trade, Martin. In other words, tell us what's going on. Julian Assange, of course, is not.
No. I'd be interested to know what law she's being prosecuted under, actually. But anyway, the point is that they're making it up as they go along. I mean, there isn't really anything in English law that Assange has done. And you in theory, you shouldn't be extradited from this country for things which are not illegal in this country.
They're saying apparently that she's a Russian spy.
Well, that's what they're doing an awful lot of this. It's the whole idea that anybody who discusses what's going on in the situation in Ukraine in a less than completely enthusiastic fashion for the lies which are coming out of the Ukrainian government, and my goodness, they've told an awful lot of lies which have been shown to be lies. And they're going after anybody that, you know, they closed down RT. As you know, I used to contribute to RT for 8 years. They've stopped phoning me now, I presume, because you can't get it in this country.
You can. No, you can.
But I think not, just, not enough people.
In fact, we're
going
to be hearing a little bit from RT in a minute, because that's what we do here. When we see things trying to be censored, what we do is we make sure we blast them out from the rooftops. And RT is one of the things they've been doing that with. But no, if you go to Odyssey, odyse.com, I think it's .com anyway. You go to Odyssey and you just type in RT into their search, you will find their live feed. And so they most definitely are around still. But they're confined to this platform where they were getting millions of viewers, tens of millions of viewers even, and rivaling the BBC for their international reach at Russia Today. They've now got the number in something like 600, 700 is what their viewership is nowadays.
Well, in this country...
No, that's on the Odyssey feed all over the world.
Yeah, well, you can see that by silencing things, you know, for example, two very, very important facts about this crisis, which happened while, you know, in recent months. One was the assassination of Kiriev, who was a delegate from the Ukrainian side to the first negotiations with the Russian side in Belarusia, came back to Kiev and was immediately shot dead by the SBU. Now, that was reported, obviously, on the Russian media and on RT, but nobody would have seen anything about it on the BBC, ITV or any of the Western media. So that's a very fundamental factual matter that people ought to have been told about that they weren't told about. And that's just one example.
Yeah, so the nice thing about the RT News live stream 24/7 on Odyssey, yes, odyse.com, is that they allow this live chat, which obviously the BBC don't do on any of their websites, and they don't allow comments either on their website, the BBC, or on their programmes or anything. They're on the live chat, on the RT News live stream, you've got all sorts of people contributing there who are critical of Putin.
Yes, and I think there are people in Russia who feel that RT has gone too far in trying to be even-handed, especially since they've been banned. I mean, what good does being Mr. Nice Guy get you? We might as well be more strident. I think they're taking the right strategy. Same as the Russian Ministry of Defence. The Ukrainians just make ridiculous, extravagant claims. We've killed 20 generals. Putin is dying of cancer. You know, there's going to be a military coup in Moscow. We have intelligence. You know, the ghost of Kiev has shot down another 10 Russian planes. And this is all regurgitated as truth by the Western media. I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, most countries, if you watch countries having a war, you'd expect, and you're not directly involved, you'd expect that you would treat both sides with some scepticism. But everything the Ukrainians say is obviously the truth. You know, it's obvious that the Russians have... I mean, you saw what happened in the Ukraine. If you follow it closely, one of the Ukrainian politicians or officials was claiming that the Russians had been raping babies. And eventually she was sacked, because she was making it up. She said, well, I made it up for the best of reasons. I wanted more weapons from the West to fight the Russians. So I thought it was okay to make up the fact that the Russians were raping babies. Now, the fact is, you can't trust a word they say. Whereas what the Russians are doing is very similar to what the British did in World War II, which is don't say much, but what you do say make sure you can take it to the bank, and then people will tune into your programmes to find out what's really going on.
Interesting, isn't it? And this is why, of course, so few youngsters today listen to any kind of terrestrial TV at all. So what was a little quiz for you here, Martin. What was Julian Assange's crime?
As I understand it, he received confidential information from Chelsea Manning, and therefore he broke the Espionage Act, and therefore he's got to be punished as a traitor.
As Peter Oborne put it, Julian Assange's supposed crime was to expose atrocities committed by the US and its allies, primarily in Afghanistan and Iraq, during the War on Terror. He shone a light on the systematic abuse dealt out to prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. He revealed the fact that more than 150 entirely innocent inmates were held for years without even being charged. One of the most embarrassing things he did was publishing a video of a helicopter gunman laughing as they casually massacred unarmed Iraqi civilians in an attack that killed around 15 people, including a Reuters cameraman and his assistant. Laughing. The US declined to discipline the perpetrators of that atrocity, but they are pursuing Assange instead to the ends of the earth for revealing that it even took place. Once in US hands, it's all but certain that Assange will spend the remainder of his life in jail, because the US is determined to show that terrible reprisals lie in store for any reporter that runs a story based on US government documents. That's why Daniel Ellsberg, the former US Marine Corps officer behind the Pentagon Papers, do you want to just say something about what they were, Martin?
Well, Ellsberg was working in the Pentagon, and he had access to the internal documents, which basically were saying, well, we're losing the war. And he realised that the Vietnam War, and the official line was, you know, one last push and we're going to win, etc., etc. And it was clear from the internal documents that wasn't the case, that they were losing. So what he did is he went into work for, you know, several months, and photocopied all of these documents and smuggled them out bit by bit, so that he then gave them to the New York Times. New York Times published them, and it was decisive, because the public opinion had been told. He said, look, this is ridiculous. They know they're losing, but they're not telling you.
They're just lying to
you. They're just lying to you, yeah.
Well, also, on top of that, the Pentagon Papers revelations of Daniel Ellsberg's exposed the secret US bombing of Cambodia and Laos.
That's right.
So this was a war that was going on that hadn't been approved by Congress, and the American public weren't supposed to know about.
That's right. And the other thing, of course, in the Assange case, is one of the things he exposed is the CIA's hacking tools, where they can hack into things and make it look as if somebody else did it and so on. And I think that really did annoy them, because these are tools that they use all the time to create disinfo on the internet.
Anybody,
and he exposed it.
To look up Vault 7, because
that's right.
We covered it at the time. Absolutely shocking. This includes things like using televisions that are on a standby to spy on, record everybody who's in the room, the hacking of vehicles, aircraft, cars, etc., to create assassinations. A bit embarrassing, isn't it? And anyway, Daniel Ellsberg says he feels a great identification with Assange's work. Edward Fitzgerald, who's Julian Assange's lawyer, has argued convincingly in court that his only crime is investigative journalism. For example, the US charge states that Assange tried to conceal the source of the disclosure of classified records. Every journalist worth his or her salt does the same, but the US insists that Assange is guilty of espionage. The British Home Secretary shamefully agrees. Whilst it's true Patel is unusually authoritarian, I suspect every recent holder of the office, Labour or Conservative, would have made an identical decision. Britain values beyond measure its security relationship with the US. Why is that?
Well, because the two establishments are completely intertwined, whether it's in the interests of ordinary people in this country to hitch ourselves to this US train is another matter altogether. Germany and France, for example, did not participate in the invasion of Iraq. They were right, we were wrong, and we bear the responsibility that they do not bear. And, of course, the consequences are that Iraqi refugees try and cross the channel, like the one that was not allowed onto the Rwanda plane in the end because of the legal challenges to what Priti Patel's trying to do.
Boris Johnson, on a recent visit to the London College of Communication, said he was alarmed by an increase in attacks on journalists worldwide and announced a £1 million fund to support press freedom. Maybe that should go to the Julian Assange campaign.
Well, that's right. I mean, they love to go on about how press freedoms are attacked all around the world, but we're still allied with Saudi Arabia, which chopped Khashoggi up with a bone saw, and we continue in alliance with them in smashing the democratic forces in Yemen. It's just the hypocrisy of it all is unbelievable.
So what happens now? There is going to be an appeal. I'll put a link up to the excellent Peter Oborne article from The Guardian today on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The Assange legal team said they're going to appeal against this decision. I mean, this seems to just go on and on, Martin, doesn't it?
Yes, and of course Assange all this while is in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison. I mean, you'd have thought that given that all this is a non-violent offence, there would be no need to do any of that. But there you go. I mean, there isn't really an offence in English law, as far as I can see. And of course, by establishing the precedent, they are attempting to subvert what little of our constitution, such as it is, remains functional.
Okay, we're going to hear from Stella Assange. Just her name has just changed. She's no longer Stella Morris. She's now Stella Assange after getting married to Julian, speaking earlier today.
I mean, I have no words to express what it's like to see the UK process being used as a way to prolong Julian's suffering again and again, and they've been... there has been every opportunity to end Julian's suffering, to let him be free, because he has to be free. He should be free. Everyone knows it. Process is being used to hide atrocity, and we know that's from history, that can be done. And the UK should not be doing that. It should not be engaging in persecution on behalf of a foreign power that is out for revenge. That foreign power that committed crimes which Julian put into the sunlight. Specific, concrete crimes that have not been prosecuted, that have been just shoved under the rug. And Julian, who has done nothing wrong, he has done everything that any self-respecting journalist should do when given evidence of a state committing crimes of corruption. They publish it because their duty is to the public. And Julian's duty to the public has landed him in prison for already more than 3 years, and he faces 175 years. We're not at the end of the road here. We're going to fight this. We're going to use every appeal avenue, and we're going to fight. I'm going to spend every waking hour fighting for Julian until he's free, until justice is served.
So that's Stella Assange there speaking earlier today. You do wonder, isn't it, don't you, whether it's eventually he is going to have to go to the United States, Martin, when this whole process, and in a way, I hate to say it, but, you know, wouldn't it be better for this whole thing to be over, because it's just such a horrific thing for the people to do to him? Is there any chance that you think of him coming out of this?
Well, there's a new Labour government in Australia, and I understand that Albanese, the guy in charge, is on the record of saying that this has got to stop, and he is an Australian citizen. Now, he may be able to put some pressure on and say, well, you know, this deal that we did, or the previous government did, about these nuclear submarines, well, you release Julian or we're going to cancel it. What about that?
Sounds like a good idea. Yeah. Okay, so in terms of... Where this leaves other journalists, what do you think? Because it's bound to have a big effect, isn't it?
Oh, it's already had a big effect. You know, this is the point of this. Don't forget that a lot of this material was actually published in The Guardian and Der Spiegel and The New York Times. They're not being prosecuted. He's being prosecuted. And that is because they're trying to distinguish between what they regard as journalism, you know, the sort of thing that we pay for, and others.
I think it's nice to contrast.
We're not journalists.
I think it's very useful to contrast this with this Anna Lipp, the German journalist, as well, because she is just literally being given the same sort of treatment. The first thing that the German authorities have done is to freeze her bank accounts. They opened a criminal case against her and froze her and her father's bank account pending a trial. She's forbidden to appear at over her reporting of Russia's military operation. You know, this is unbelievable, isn't it? So not only is her account frozen, it makes you think that you maybe shouldn't bother with a bank account if it could be frozen at any time.
Well, it makes it difficult for you to do your job, which is the whole point. You know, a lot of harassment.
Well, maybe a Russian bank account.
Well, maybe. They're probably ways round, but all of this harassment has its effect.
You know what? This reminds me of the seizure of money by the Western authorities, of the Russian money in the Western bank accounts. The idea is, if they're going to start to use seizure of bank accounts as a way to try and shut down people, control people they don't like, then obviously people are going to start moving their money around the world.
Well, that's
right.
I mean, ultimately, I hope that all of this is going to be self-defeating, because you make yourself look culpable when you try to cover up people investigating your lies.
I suppose their hope is,
but of course
they
do it because it works.
Well, their hope is that the press won't cover this. That's what they do, that they can shut people's, like this German journalist Anna Lipp's bank account and her father, unbelievably, even though he apparently hasn't actually done anything wrong. He's not supposed to be a Russian spy, but he might give money to her, so let's close his bank account too. The idea is that we can do this without any reporting of it, and this is on this isn't on one of the mainstream websites. This is on something called yournews.com, this stuff this week about Anna. And so, in a way, actually, the mainstream press have simply gone along with this and covering this story up.
I very much doubt it. What the mainstream press do is they take press releasings from the Ukrainian Ministry of Defence and just, publish them. They certainly don't go out to the front line to ask people what's going on. That's not what they do at all. And the other thing that happens, of course, to journalists in Colombia, for example, a lot, is they just have nasty accidents, car accidents, robberies.
Accidents can happen.
That's the one.
The new White Rose of Germany, she's called Anna Lipp. Anyway, so I'll put links up to the articles about Anna and obviously about Julian, and just the general attack on the truth, which is what this is, and about free press, even though at the same time, of course, they're moaning at the Saudis for assassinating Khashoggi, the journalist.
They're not moaning that much.
No?
No.
They're still doing deals with them, buying oil from them.
Our military personnel are still embedded in Saudi Arabia, repressing and killing the people of Yemen.
So a pretty comprehensive look at press freedom there, I hope. One of the things, of course, another thing that hasn't been covered is this Bilderberg conference. Happened roughly 2 weeks ago now, but we covered it with Charlie Skelton last week and in various other ways. And I noticed an enterprising chap called Josh Friedman turned up at the airport in Washington and was wishing goodbye to various of the Bilderberg attendees who were catching their planes back to Austria. And there's a guy called Andreas Treckel. And another one, this was the guy they spoke to. He runs one of the big banks in Austria. He was over at Bilderberg. And talking of banks, shutting people's bank accounts down, this is the sort of guy that does that kind of thing. A little bit power crazy, you might say. So here's Josh Friedman collaring Andreas Treckel at the Washington airport just after the Bilderberg conference, Bilderberg 2022, the Sunday before last.
Mr. Treckel, what about the disruptions to the global financial system? That was a key topic this year.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
How bad?
It's pretty bad. It's a serious situation, and we have to be extremely careful that the people in Europe don't suffer from that.
And was there any consensus at the meeting about what could be done so people don't suffer?
We're not talking about that. It's a private meeting.
So he says there at the end, he says, was there any consensus at Bilderberg about this? He says, we're not talking about that. It's a private meeting. Maybe he doesn't quite understand Chatham House rules. You can talk about what was discussed at Bilderberg, but you're not allowed to name who told you it, especially if it's Henry Kissinger.
Well, that may be so, and it may be that that there is no consensus. I can imagine that there was probably quite a lot of.
Anyway, he's using the words "serious situation," referring to the coming global financial disruption.
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but the Federal Reserve's increased the base interest rate in the US for the highest level in one go in 30 years. And that's rather stolen the thunder of the Bank of England's increase in interest rates, and stock markets have started to take fright. And as the sanctions on Russia begin to bite on Europe, because that's where the blow is going to fall, the European economies could slide. Britain is sliding into recession. It looks like we're sliding in first because we've got particular problems. And then the banking system will collapse as it did in 2008.
It didn't collapse in 2008.
Well, it didn't collapse because they bailed it out, but they can't bail it out again.
Maybe they can. They could just
make up
some more funny
money. If they were going to bail it out again, they'd have kept interest rates at zero.
Oh, right.
Yes. Well, so in actual fact, they've decided not to bail it out again.
Maybe they could bail it out.
No, you can't do that by increasing interest rates. You could try and drive into the crash by keeping interest rates low and increasing public expenditure. But the danger of that is that you would get hyperinflation. So that they don't want to do that. And that means in actual fact, you're going to get a crash. Because you shouldn't be driving at this speed. All the policies that have been pursued since 2008 were the wrong policies. At a certain point, you've got to reverse them.
It wasn't a crash, was it? It was a bailout. Let's just make that clear.
Say it wasn't a crash, millions of people in the United States, just in the United States, lost their jobs and their homes. For them, it was a crash. It wasn't a crash for Wall Street, but for ordinary people, it was a disaster. So what you're actually talking about is that bailing them out, bailed them out. It didn't bail everybody else out. We're still living with much reduced living standards for ordinary people all over the world as a result of the last crash, and it's going to be worse this time. And that crash is going to hurt ordinary people. They will survive.
Now, I've got a little bee in my bonnet about something called the RTFO, which no one's heard of, called the Renewable Transport Fuel Obligation. Now, this is an increase in fuel prices that happened on the 1st of January this year. It's a carbon offset tax, mm-hmm. Part of the COP26 and whatever they are, 25, 24. And 20 pence extra is quite a lot on fuel. But I looked at the fuel prices over that time, and actually over the Christmas and New Year period, there was no great leap of 20 pence in the fuel. So what the oil companies were doing was they actually absorbed that into their own when the fuel price went up, when they were having to pay more in tax for the fuel, and so nobody really noticed that that this tax had gone up in 20 pence. If you actually sit and think about it, that's a 15% increase in the price of fuel over Christmas. And of course over a couple of months after Christmas, then they started to ramp up the price of fuel. But nobody really associated it with this renewable transport fuel obligation. Anyway, so this could be one of the main sources of the inflation we've seen this year, couldn't it? 15% increase in price of fuel.
But it's only in Britain. Inflation.
No, inflation in the UK. Yeah.
Yes, that's what I mean. But the inflation is actually taking hold in the global economy because of supply constraints, and also because of the mismanagement.
Well, I don't think so. I think the fuel has a massive input. If you're putting fuel prices up as they've done in this country, roughly 20% over the last 3 or 4 months. No, since September, autumn 2021. That has a massive knock-on effect on everything, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
I was just, it does, by the way, if you look around the world, View Services this week, and I was chatting to one of the lorry drivers there. He says now it's costing about £800 to fill up a lorry.
Yes, and all over the world, in the US, they've got much, much lower fuel prices than we have. But their economy is totally dependent on those low fuel prices. So if it just rises a little bit, their economy starts to fall down the drain. Other countries, like Venezuela, have got very low fuel prices because they produce oil, but they then subsidise it to the ordinary people.
Socialism in oil, because Michael Hudson talked about things like this infrastructure.
Yes.
The stuff we need to go, needs to be provided at cost. It clearly isn't being.
No.
It's being given this green tax. Apparently, you're offsetting all the nasty carbon by paying this extra 20 pence a litre.
The obvious thing to do is cut the Gordian knot in a socialist fashion and nationalise all energy production. And then, of course, you can make a plan for what you want to do. But, of course, we've got the delusion that this is all private sector and we can't touch that, which is totally wrong. It's not. I mean, Statoil in Norway is a classic. You know, it's just across the North Sea there. They own their own oil industry. The Russians own their own oil industry, so they can use it as part of a global battle against the global capitalists who are up against.
We own quite a lot of our own railway network at the moment, but that's for later on. We'll be talking about the RMT strike in a little while. Sticking with the economics of all of this, one of my favourite commentators on the economy is a guy called King Mervyn. Of course, his actual real name is Mervyn King. He's a former Bank of England governor. And he is warning right now of a very unpleasant period ahead, rather like the Bilderbergers were saying.
Well, a mistake is to believe that you can make accurate forecasts. I mean, economists on the 1st of January each year tend to make forecasts. They're always wrong. But there are good reasons why. Stuff happens. 1st of January 2020... all the economic forecasts published then, you could have torn up a few weeks later with the pandemic. 2021, at the beginning of the year, people were trying to forecast how quickly the economy would come back. We had a second wave. Forecasts, again, didn't make much sense. 1st of January 2022, no one forecast the Russian invasion of Ukraine. They didn't build it into their economic forecasts. So these forecasts are always going to be wrong. The more important thing to do is not to pretend that we know that inflation is going to be 3.2% in a particular year, but we try to identify the risks. What are the risks on the upside and the downside? What actions can we take to mitigate those risks? That's what policy is really all about. And if you think about the risks today, the risks are firmly, I think, on the side of inflation becoming more ingrained into the system, because we keep talking about it, we expect it to happen, and we adjust our wage demands and our price setting decisions accordingly. And it's very important to try and get back to a world in which we thankfully stop talking about inflation once more.
Is it significant or relevant that this has begun with energy? I mean, does energy play a particular role? A lot of economists kind of almost try not to think about it, just treat it as an input. But is there a significance to the fact that there's, you know, we've got very high energy costs, and does that make it kind of somewhat different, somewhat faster to previous recessions?
Well, I think there are two ways in which it is different. The first one is that it clearly impacts different people in different ways, and it hurts particularly people on low incomes, because you cannot change your heating system. You can't just say, oh, gas has gone up in price, maybe I'll switch to it, you know, heat pump or something. You can't do that at all quickly. So you're stuck with it. There's no real action. And these terrible stories of people just switching off the heating illustrate the only course of action they can take. So it affects the welfare of people on low incomes significantly. I think the second is a wider reflection of the same problem. But the real issue here is that we don't produce all the energy ourselves. So we have to import quite a lot. And that means that when energy prices go up, it's a bit like the rest of the world imposing a tax on us as a country. So as a country, we're worse off. And there's nothing we can do about that. That makes it much, much harder to provide help and support for those who are hardest hit, because it's going to double down on the hit on people on average incomes or on better off incomes. And there just aren't enough very rich people to tap, to transfer, to keep the rest of us from suffering too much. Everyone basically takes a hit when energy prices go up. And we can talk about how to make it, you know, to help people on low incomes. But the idea that there is any way which as a country we can avoid this problem isn't true when it comes to energy.
So, yes, when it comes to energy, apparently their hands are tied, Martin.
Well, every buyer has a seller. The energy producers, the corporations you were talking about earlier, they're in a very strong position in this situation, as are countries which have significant oil supplies.
Well, Britain does have oil supplies.
Not enough.
Not enough.
That's why we have to import. The Russians don't have to import. We do.
Right. So gas and oil, these forms of energy, really, if it's not in state hands, surely the whole point here is that they can just they can price fix, they can actually control the market themselves.
Well, in the past, the Seven Sisters, which were the Western oil companies, they dominated the policy of the Western governments. So, you know, we participated in the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Iran in 1954 because they nationalised British Petroleum, which was in fact owned by the British government, but of course subsequently became an independent private. I mean, this idea of having, you know, Hudson's very good on all of this. These companies are natural monopolies. You know, there's no real competition. The spot market, which has been used to try and, you know, the Poles, for example, decided they didn't want cheap Russian energy at agreed prices, and they wanted to go to the international market. So they went to court in London to to get out of the contracts they'd signed with the Russians, and then of course they had to go to the spot markets just as the price went through the roof. And of course futures markets in energy mean that a barrel of oil on a futures market can be way, way above the actual market price on the day that you want to buy it. So it's that, you know, the private ownership of this infrastructure, coupled with speculative futures markets, mean that you're incredibly vulnerable.
Andrew Bailey,
that's why governments used to control this stuff, because they knew it's the means of making war, for a start. You know, the whole battle in the Eastern Front in World War II partly was to control the oil fields in the Caucasus, and if the Germans had concentrated on that, they might have won.
Andrew Bailey is the current governor of the Bank of England. You just heard from Mervyn King, previous governor, before Mark Carney, who, of course, was at Bilderberg weekend before last. He talks about the apocalyptic. He issued an apocalyptic warning over food prices, didn't he, a few weeks ago, 16th of May, in fact. This is a bit of a, well, it's an interesting word he used. Apocalyptic,
yes,
well, is not, yes, like...
Well, this is the mainstream covering their backside for when we get the crash, which may be before the end of the year. And they'll say, well, we did predict it. I mean, as the Queen famously said in 2008, why didn't anybody predict this? And, of course, the mainstream economists just had to cough and shuffle because they hadn't predicted it. But, of course, plenty of economists like Hudson had predicted it. It's just that they don't have any influence. It's pretty clear what's going to happen here. There is going to be a crash of the everything bubble, and there's pretty good consensus about this from both left-wing and right-wing economists.
Someone that should know what's going on is a guy called Jamie Dimon. He's chairman of the board and the chief executive officer of JP Morgan Chase & Company, global financial services firm, with assets of, roughly $3.2 trillion. And worldwide operations. They often turn up at the Bilderberg conferences too, funnily enough. But he had some interesting things to say, a similar theme, where he's talking, I think it's, he's basically now screaming like that apparently there's going to be some sort of economic collapse. So let's have a listen to Jamie Dimon on the Unseen interview a couple of weeks ago.
You mentioned storm clouds.
Yeah, I'm going to change the storm clouds, because I said there are three things that we're going through, which are, I hate the word unprecedented, which are kind of unprecedented. And you got to put this in back of your mind. When you've seen things that have never happened before, then you have to question your ability to predict, okay? One is huge growth in this country driven by fiscal and monetary stimulation. That isn't a normal recovery, okay? And that fiscal stimulation is still in the pocketbooks of consumers. They're spending it. They're spending it at very strong levels. And the data is completely distorted. It's distorted by inflation. It's distorted by, they went from goods back to services. It's distorted by all these things. But jobs are plentiful. Wages are going up. Consumers are spending. The lower income folks, not quite as much as before, but everybody else, it looks like they have $2 trillion more. Savings rate drop. I don't think that's going to stop the spending in 6 or 9 months. So that to me is the bright clouds out there. But it's different. the Fed has to meet this now with raising rates and QT. And the new part of this isn't the raising rates, it's the QT. The QT has, we've never had QE before like this. Therefore, we've never had QT like this. So you're looking at something they're going to be writing history books on for 50 years. What was QE? What worked? What didn't work? I think a lot of parts of QE backfired. I think the negative rates was probably a huge mistake for a whole bunch of different reasons I won't bore you with now. But they're going to have to raise rates. And they, in my view, they have to do QT. They do not have a choice because there's so much liquidity in the system. They have to remove some of the liquidity to stop the speculation, to reduce home prices, stuff like that. And you've never been through QT. So all the major buyers, if you go back to 2010 and say, who are all the major buyers of treasuries all that time? It was central banks, foreign exchange managers, banks who were topping up their liquidity profiles because we had to for regulations. All three, it won't happen the go round. Banks are topped up. Foreign exchange managers are topped up. The central bank will be selling, not buying. And governments have much more fiscal deficit to finance. That's a huge change in the flow of funds around the world. I don't know what the effect of that is. I'm prepared for, I can tell you about minimum huge volatility. And the third thing is Ukraine. That you've not had a European land war since 1945. Okay. And you could, and the complexity of Ukraine is we don't know the outcome. I always make a list, you know, if you predict the outcome, well, you couldn't predict the outcome of Vietnam, Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, 10 other conflagrations. All wrong. Wars go bad. They go south. They have unintended consequences. And this happens to be roiling the commodity markets of the world. Wheat, oil, gas, and stuff like that, which in my view will continue. We're not taking the proper actions to protect Europe from what's going to happen in oil in the short run. And we're not taking the proper actions to protect you all what's going to happen to oil in the next 5 years, which means it almost has to go up the price. We're not investing enough money, you know, to keep oil a number. And for all those who love climate change, if oil prices go to 175 or 150, which I kind of think is in the cards, to tell you the truth, you know, not in the immediate run, but down the road, then CO2 won't go up, down, which is everyone predicts because people buy less oil and gas. It's going to go up because all those other countries out there, the poor countries who need oil and gas to feed and heat their citizens, will turn off, will not buy oil and gas, they'll buy coal. That's what's going to happen. CO2 will go up, it won't come down. And we're not dealing with these challenges. So those three things, fiscally induced growth, QT, Ukraine war. Look, I'm an optimist. You know, I said there are storm clouds, there are big storm clouds. It's a hurricane. Right now it's kind of sunny, things are doing fine. You know, everyone thinks the Fed can handle this. That hurricane is right out there down the road coming our way. We just don't know if it's a minor one or Superstorm Sandy or Andrew or something like that. And you better brace yourself. So JP Morgan is bracing ourselves, and we're going to be very conservative in our balance sheet. On, you know, with all this capital uncertainty, we're going to have to take actions. And you know, I kind of want to shed non-operating deposits again, which we can do in size, you know, to protect ourselves so we can serve clients in bad times. And so that's the environment we're dealing with. And, you know, I think it's okay to hope that I'll end up okay. I hope it. That's my Goldilocks. I hope. Who the hell knows?
Who the hell knows, Martin? So he's saying there's lots of these ingredients in the equations now, which are, unknowns. And this QT he's talking about, everyone's heard of QE, quantitative easing, which was printing money. But QT is quantitative tightening.
That's right.
So this is just basically
if you remember a few years ago, there was something called the taper tantrum, where the Federal Reserve said...
they wanted to taper QE.
Yes, they wanted to taper QE because they're basically, you know, the financial markets have become addicted to financial heroin, which is all the free money that you're talking about. And, of course, as soon as they perceived that they weren't getting the heroin that they've been used to, they immediately started to collapse. So they then had to go back to giving them the same heroin.
There's something a bit messed
up. Now we're going to go for cold turkey, which of course is going to mean the crashes in the stock market. It's the obvious. When he talks about the Ukraine war, he hasn't mentioned the main problem with the Ukraine war, which is the Western sanctions on Russia. That's totally self-inflicted. The West didn't have to do that. But by doing that, they really, I mean, the financial people have, like Dimon, have been rather excluded from the decisions about things like this. So they were saying, well, don't do that because that's going to kill us. But the sort of more political, well, I'm sure we can put sanctions on.
I thought it was
on,
so fascinating.
They haven't really thought it through. The financial people said, well, that's just going to kill us off.
As all these Greens and XR people are rubbing their hands over the price of oil going up and inflation as a result, he's saying there, actually, this is not good. I mean, I quite like Jamie Dimon in that, you know, because these people are in charge of such vast sums of money, they've really got to know what's going on. And he's saying, actually, it's going to mean an increase in the use of coal. So don't rub your hands and don't shout and scream and say how wonderful this is. No.
Well, in actual fact, what's going to happen as a result of the inflation, everybody's worried about inflation. It's not in the inflation that's the problem. Inflation eats away at people's capacity. In the past, they used to have wage price spirals, yeah, because trade unions were strong in this country particularly, and others even more so, and they just bargained for the inflation rate each time they went to bargain. Now what happens when inflation kicks in is poor people can't bargain up their wages, and they just get less money, and that then they can't go out and spend as much as they used to. He's talking about his bank is going to be very conservative, he's going to pull in its horns, and we're not going to be doing anything too speculative. But by doing that, that's what brings the crash on. Everybody makes the decision that I'm going to save a bit of money here. That's what I need to do in case there's a crash. And as everybody does that, that is the crash, because all of the demand yeah. falls drops out of the economy.
It? The psychology behind
it
is fascinating.
It's what Keynes called the liquidity trap.
So this did find its way, these kind of topics did find their way into Prime Minister's questions this week, as Keir Starmer asked Boris about these tax rises and low growth. He's saying, well, look, actually, you're basically living in cloud cuckoo land. The economy is going down the drain, and all you're trying to do is use a bit of bluster to make out it's all fine, but it's not.
Mr. Speaker, 15 tax rises and we're sat for the highest tax burden since rationing. He says the economy's booming when it's shrinking. He's game playing so much. He thinks he's on Love Island. Trouble is, Prime Minister, I'm reliably informed that contestants that give the public the ick get booted out. And it's not just low growth. He's also lost control of inflation. He was warned about this last September. And what did he do? He dismissed it. He didn't act. He sat on his hands. Now prices are through the roof, and we're set to have the highest inflation in the G7. When will he accept he got it badly wrong when he claimed that worries about inflation were unfounded?
Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker, we're helping people with the cost of living with £1,200. On the 14th of July, the money will be going into people's bank accounts. Why can we do that, Mr. Speaker? Because we have the fiscal firepower to do it, because the economy is in robust shape, with record numbers of people in payrolled employment, Mr. Speaker. And that is thanks to the steps that we took that he continuously opposed. And if he wants to, and I just remind Mr. Speaker, he has a chance. I won't say this interrogatively, Mr. Speaker. He has the chance now to clear it up. He can oppose the Labour's rail strikes right now. Say, he can disagree and give him that opportunity. Let him disagree with the union barons who would add to people's costs in the coming weeks.
Well, of course, not necessarily of course, but Keir Starmer was distancing himself from the rail strikes after that. This whole business of, Boris there saying, oh, the economy's doing fine, we've got more people than ever in employment.
Well, what I'd say about this is we've had over a decade now of quantitative easing and zero interest rates. Now, in the past, that would have created a raging, I mean, you wouldn't have done that. Normally you'd expect the economy to grow at about maybe 3% a year and inflation to be, you know, 2%. And having decades of zero, effectively, interest rates, capitalism can't work with zero interest rates in the long run. And also...
Why not?
Because there has to be a real price of money. And, you know, this, what's happened is that they've basically thrown the textbook out of the window. And even with all firepower turned on, including just money printing, all they can do is just about keep the economy from collapsing.
This is people's savings. This is people's day-to-day living costs, allowances, electricity bills, kids' food and things like that. But they seem to have taken it out of the real world.
Yeah, well, that's right. And the fact is that the capitalist system globally has only been able to just about keep itself afloat, even with all of this money printing and all the rest of it. That means that it's actually... We haven't got a cold. We've got terminal cancer.
Are there any Jamie Dimon types, Bilderbergers, etc., that might actually want to cause a crash and profit from it?
Happened?
Or are they all doing their best in a public-spirited way to avoid it?
Well, there's two levels to it, isn't there? There's a people who work in the stock market. They sell stocks. It's not in their interest to go out there and say, buy stocks because they're going to go down in price, is it? That's not how they sell stocks. And then on the other hand, you've got very big players who are basically trying to reshape the global economy in terms of controlling natural resources and geopolitical power. And they, of course, are trying as we speak to crash the Russian economy. That's what we're trying to do.
But we don't seem to be able to do it, but
that's what we're trying to do. So when you say they're deliberately trying to crash the global economy, we're deliberately trying to crash the Russian economy.
Rather stupid
that is a deliberate
people.
Thing,
some
isn't
rather
it?
Stupid people. I mean, that's all you can call them. Stupid people decided that they thought that by having all these massive sanctions on Russia, it would damage the Russians. It hasn't. It's strengthened the Russians.
Well, it's still causing problems for the Russians, but Michael Hudson has pointed out, what they've been doing is forcing the Russians to do what they should have done anyway, which is to make their economy less dependent on Western finance and input. And they were probably going to do that anyway, but they've now had to do it. And of course, it's actually been good for them. They should have done it years ago. They should never have allowed the Jeffrey Sachs and others to come in and tell them to, carry out a shock therapy privatization program. Absolutely idiotic. And of course, once you've done it, what you've got to do is stop doing it and start doing sensible stuff, which is what they have done.
Okay, sticking with the cost of living crisis.
Mr. Speaker, millions of families across our country are suffering because of the cost of living emergency. And people in rural areas are especially hurting, bearing the brunt of record fuel price rises. The Rural Fuel Duty Relief Scheme is supposed to help by taking money off the price of petrol. But some rural counties aren't eligible, like Cumbria, like Shropshire, and like Devon. Mr. Speaker, the Conservative Party is wanting to hear ideas to help those people, and I think the people of Devon will note. Because there are families and pensioners across rural counties who are missing out on this support. So, Mr. Speaker, as petrol prices soar, will the Prime Minister accept our idea to help people in rural counties and expand rural fuel duty relief?
Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker, we cut fuel duty for everybody across the country by record sums. He talks about pensioners, Mr. Speaker. We're giving £850 more to every pensioner across the country. And he talks about the cost of energy. Everybody is going to get another £400 to help them with the costs of energy. And the blissful fact about the Liberal Democrats, Mr. Speaker, is people don't actually know what their policies are. And they're able to go around the country. They're able to go around the country bamboozling the rural communities, not revealing that they're in fact in favour of massive new green taxes, Mr. Speaker, which is what they want, and not revealing that they would like to go back straight away into the common agricultural policy with all the bureaucracy and all the costs that entails. They don't say that on the doorstep, Mr. Speaker.
Well, so that was a question from Lib Dem leader Eb Davey. Martin, this whole business of giving loads of people £400 a year, I mean, why, it does seem a very strange bureaucratic way to do things. Why can't they just subsidise the cost of fuel?
Well, if you subsidise the cost of fuel, you're subsidising it for everybody. Yeah. So the wealthy get that money as well. So there is an argument for targeting your help to the people who need the help. And of course, if you actually own the infrastructure that supplies fuel and energy, you can finesse this a lot easier, as they're doing in France, because they do.
Boris is saying, well, all this extra money's going to pensioners, etc.
Well, what they're doing is, don't forget, they were swearing blind that they weren't going to do any of this a few weeks ago, and they're now making a virtue of the fact that they are doing it, only because people like Sir Ed Davey have been pestering him to do it. So it's a bit, I mean, it's shameless Boris Johnson trying to beat Ed Davey over the head with the policy that he's...
Ed Davey's policy. Erosion of people's disposable income has been going on really since the 1970s, at least. Now it's got to the point where it's getting critical for many families, where they may actually get evicted because they can't either afford to pay the rent or mortgages. This subject also came up with the cost of living crisis, a little bit closer to home, actually, just over the Severn Estuary in Cardiff.
Anna McMahon.
Thank you. Why is it that the worst people often rise to the highest office and stay there? Not my words about the Prime Minister, but those of his newest appointment, his cost of living czar. Families across Cardiff North, crippled with skyrocketing bills, unable to afford even the most basic necessities, all agree with him, saying this Prime Minister has to go. So if his own czar doesn't even have faith in him, tell me why those struggling should.
Prime Minister. Mrs. Speaker, she's asked that question repeated, but let me just remind her that this is a government that gets on and delivers on our promises to the people, and in particular, getting Brexit done. I read the other day, Mrs. Speaker, that she wants to go back into the single market and into the customs union. If that's the real policy of the Labour Party, Mr. Speaker, going back into the EU, then why won't the shadow, why won't the leader of the opposition admit it?
So the actual cost of living czar, as they've just announced this, is a guy called David Buttress, former founder and chief executive of Just Eat PLC. I don't know quite what Just Eat are, but it's some sort of roadside chain of
No, it's not. It's what, it, what it is, it's, like, it's a web startup where you can order food from local restaurants.
So what qualifications has he got of being a czar?
He's an entrepreneur, Tony. A wealth creator. And therefore, one of the people that should have some idea about how
he's going to work with the private sector to develop business-led initiatives to help consumers. I mean, this is the whole way everything's going nowadays, is it? The government can do nothing. We've got no money. We're just there to go on the TV and pretend we have and come out with bluster. And actually, the only people that can actually really do anything is business-led.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that the government's got no money is fundamentally wrong. Especially in a situation like this, it's important to actually look at what your actual resources are and don't make any false economies. I mean, part of the problem is that Rishi Sunak and that sort and people like that in the Tory party still want to have tax cuts so they can win the next election, and they don't want to go back to having the sort of taxes on wealth that were absolutely normal in the 1950s.
Well, one of the groups of people that are having so much, this is impacting them a lot, are the rail workers. Now, there's been a lot of, bad feeling whipped up by the London press against the rail workers who want to go on strike next week. They don't want to go on strike. They are going on strike. The point is here that they are trying to maintain. All they're trying to do is maintain their wages. Their real wages have dropped, Martin.
That's right. And they're also concerned about job losses and pensions. It's really a question of, what we did have was a nationalised railway system like in France, where there was centralised bargaining, everybody knew where they stood, and the whole system. What the privatisation of the railways did, paradoxically, is that railway workers are actually quite a strong union, because you can't just replace railway workers. Not everybody can drive a train.
Well, surely you can just replace people that run P&O ferries, can't you? Just with any old casual worker.
Yeah, but that's not quite the same.
No, you can't. Railways. You can't do it. You can't do it. Just bring casual staff in to do these skilled jobs.
That used to be the power of the unions. The NUR, as it then was balanced by the fact that the government owned the railways, so that they were not able, because they had one big employer to deal with, they were not able to actually, the government could dig its heels in. Whereas with the privatised rail companies, they had to increase the wages of the rail staff because the rail staff were in a stronger position to bargain with them. Yeah. And the RMT, under the guy's name escapes me now, doesn't matter.
Bob Crowe?
Bob Crowe, that's right. The reason why Bob Crowe got re-elected and re-elected is because he drove up, he ruthlessly used the privatised railway system to drive up wages. And yeah, of course, he's very successful.
Wonderful guy, very outspoken. It was on Question Time, and I put a clip up on my Public Inquiry channel on YouTube about that, which has done extremely well, something like 70,000 views. People just love the guy because he spoke the truth. Anyway, the RMT came up in Prime Minister's questions too here.
List West.
Hey. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, in just 5 days, rail passengers across the UK and in the North East will be facing huge disruption. Of the biggest rail dispute in a generation, it's emerged that ministers have not held any talks whatsoever since March. So, Mr. Speaker, I ask the Prime Minister.
You don't know.
I ask the Prime Minister, has he met with trade unions and employers in the rail industry to attempt to bring this dispute to an end? Yes or no?
Mr. Speaker, I noticed that one union baron was asked about this. He said, "I don't negotiate with the Tory government," is what he said. That's what they said, Mr. Speaker. We all know how much money the Labour front bench take from the RMT, Mr. Speaker. We know why they're sitting on their hands during Labour's rail strikes. They should come out and condemn it, Mr. Speaker.
So he thinks that by calling them Labour's rail strikes that he can get somewhere, even though Starmer said, we actually don't support the strike, which, of course, he should be supporting, but he doesn't want to support it for whatever reason. I don't support them, he says. Anyway, Martin, look, where do you think this is heading, this strike?
Well, it seems that it's going to go ahead. I doubt very much that anything's going to happen to stop it.
The government aren't talking to them, are they?
No.
Is there any point in the government talking to them? Sort of illusion, isn't it,
it's
been privatised.
In the past, especially when it was a nationalised industry, the government would certainly have been talking to them.
Well, the Department for Transport and Grant Shapps, Transport Secretary, or whoever Transport Secretary is these days, surely should be talking to the union and then using that, putting some pressure on the train operating companies to agree to their terms. But I suppose we've got a situation here where you've got this these big shareholder train operating companies in the middle between Railtrack, which is nationally owned, and the passengers, and they have to get their pound of flesh every year. They've got to make more and more money.
Well, this is the RMT's case.
They're trimming down the staff.
Well, as you know, during the pandemic, in actual fact, the privatised rail companies effectively had to be taken over by the government because they weren't making any money.
And I talked to Steve Headley in a minute about that.
Yeah, but so in other words,
they call it really modernisation. This is what annoys me. They are modernising. Now, we're modernising by getting rid of guards, which means there's only one driver on a train. They're getting rid of all the staff from the stations.
Yeah.
They are turning the whole thing into some sort of automated. They're even trying in some cases in London to use automatic trains with no drivers at all.
Well, that's right. And this isn't modernisation. It's sweating the assets to make the maximum out of them for private profit.
Absolutely correct. Anyway, so I spoke earlier today to a former Rail Maritime Transport Union Deputy General Secretary Steve Headley about the coming strike and asked him many of these points. So This, I hope, will fill in the gaps left by the useless London media in not really explaining what this strike is about, just going on and on and on, belly aching basically about, oh, we won't be able to get to work on the train, isn't it terrible? Well, actually, what about the fact that human beings work on these railways and that they need to be well looked after, and we would rather like it as passengers that they're well looked after so that they're happy in their work, they do a good job, and we are kept safe on the trains.
My name's Steve Headley. I've been on the railway for 35 years, 15 of them I spent working for the RMP as regional organiser, assistant general secretary and senior assistant general secretary.
What about as part of your job? Were you a railway worker yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I was on signals and telecoms engineering for about 20 odd years before I became a full-time official.
Can you tell us what you make of this strike next week? I mean, we haven't heard actually very much of the detail from the London media about actually what is behind the strike, so maybe you could help us with that too.
Well, there's a couple of things behind the strikes. There's firstly the pay rise. People have had a pay cut effectively for the past 3 years, inflation's rampant, and they haven't had a pay rise at all, so their wages have gone down by 25% in real terms. They're also looking to take out thousands of jobs. And at the same time, they're paying shareholders billions of pounds. Shareholders who didn't work through the pandemic, who sat at home twiddling their thumbs. The private railway companies had over 20 billion in subsidies over the pandemic, and none of that is going into the pockets of the workers. So that's why people are going on strike, to get a decent pay rise, to keep pace with inflation, and to defend jobs.
I mean, some have suggested that it might be better to take a leaf out of the other unions from around the world and say, still work those days, it's just not collect the revenue, not collect the tickets, not check tickets, allow passengers to get off on and off the trains for free. And I know this was a very successful tactic used in Japan and other countries.
Yeah, the problem with that is that we've got an automated system over here. We've got gates that take the tickets automatically. So that just wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. People would be charged if they didn't tap in and tap out. So, I mean, obviously, if we could do that, it would be considered that it wouldn't work in Britain, especially in London.
What about the RMT itself? Because I understand that there's been quite a lot of controversy about the current leadership.
Well, the current leadership are crossing a picket line outside of their very door. They've sacked a worker. They sacked a worker who they had originally made redundant. He protested about his redundancy. They reinstated him, and then they sacked him. And it's an absolute disgrace that people who are really should be leading, and RMT members are the best people in this country, working class heroes, proud of every one of them. The leadership are letting them down badly.
The idea of having less and less staff, I mean, this has obviously happened since the hundreds of thousands of people worked on the railways back in the 1960s. Don't you think it's inevitable that the whole thing is going to become pretty much automatic with contactless payments everywhere and automatic barriers? There's no real need for staff.
Well, the thing is, the automatic barrier can't actually help somebody if they're in trouble, can't help passengers on or off trains, can't evacuate if there's an emergency. Like we've seen in Manchester, the bombing in Manchester, if we had more staff on hand, you know, and if we had less staff on hand, the difficulties would have been far greater, people injured and killed maybe. So we need staff there for safety reasons and to reassure the travelling public. We're not against technology at all. Technology is a part of life, but what technology should be used for is to make everyone's life easier, to cut down hours that people have to work, and have productivity which workers can be paid. But what we have now at the minute is we've got a very depleted workforce. The railway is running on overtime, and they want to get rid of thousands of people, and those that are left will just have their terms and conditions torn up, so they'll have to work longer hours, they'll have to work more weekends, and their work-life balance will go down the drain.
Look, I mean, for example, on trains themselves, we quite often find trains operating with only one person on nowadays. What's the problem with that? Is there any problem at all?
Well, if you look at what happened several times, we've had guards who have been on trains who have evacuated in an emergency. So we need two people. The very, very least, we need two people on a train in case of an emergency. If a driver becomes incapacitated, if the driver cannot reach the customers and the travellers in the train, then the guard is the person to do that. And we've had several examples of guards evacuating trains all on their own.
And what about at stations? Do we really need people there?
Well, how are disabled people got to access trains? You know, we've got 40% of the stations in Britain, they're non-accessible to unaided disabled people. And we need people there to help people get on and off trains. And we need people there to ensure safety.
The train operating companies, what we've seen is we've seen quite a few of those have to be renationalised, which is quite shocking under a Tory government. Can you just take us through which ones are now actually under public ownership and why?
Right, so we've got LNER, London North Eastern Railway, East Coast Main Line has come back in. We've got GTR in the south, and they've come back in because basically they've milked the billions of pounds and subsidies that the government have given them, all during, well, since the 27 years of privatisation, they've been involved in one form or another, milking our industry, paying out their shareholders billions. And when the pandemic came along, and they were guaranteed a profit anyway, don't get me wrong, but the absolute incompetence that they displayed meant that the government, even this Tory government, ideologically opposed the renationalisation. Had to take those franchises back off them because they were run so badly.
Finally, Steve, what message would you have for passengers who are going to be frustrated next week?
The whole of Britain needs a pay raise. We understand it's frustrating for you, but what we want to do is get everybody a pay raise. We want to smash this glass ceiling that they've put on workers' wages. We can't see the continued redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich. All workers in Britain deserve a pay raise. You stand with us, we'll stand with you.
Okay, Steve Headley, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that was refreshing, wasn't it? It's about, in the past, people used to know that when people went on strike, it was a reason, and there was an automatic sympathy. And we need to get that kind of mentality back.
Well, I think it's difficult, isn't it, when the mass media just sort of talk about, oh, they're causing disruption. And also, one of the things that really doesn't help is when the Labour Party doesn't back them.
The Labour Party are going to do that because they're trying to triangulate. The RMT might very well say, well, you know, why should we fund you then? So that's an issue that would have to be, you know, this is an issue, isn't it? But in the past, there would have been a more robust attitude from the Labour Party as well. It's, look, you know, we are the Labour Party, and if people need to go on strike, then we will support
them. Well, I mean, they're supposed to be the Labour Party, and here are people who are fighting back against the cost of living crisis, trying to maintain their paying conditions. But Keir Starmer is looking the other way.
Well, what they're trying to say is what should happen is a negotiation to avoid a strike, which, you know, you could say that they ought to be cheering it on, but you can see that they're going to say that. But it's at the end of the day, it's not what they say, it's what we do that counts.
Well, it Workers is. It is what they say. Themselves. I mean, you know, actually, if Starmer was to stand up in the House of Commons and say what we just heard from Steve Headley, for example, that rail workers have had to suffer a 25% loss in wages over the last 2 years, whilst the shareholders who haven't not been working through the pandemic have been raking it in, then, I mean, surely, why can't he say things like that?
Because he's not Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn is saying things like that. That's
exactly
what he's saying.
Nobody's listening to Jeremy. That's why he was supposedly never going to be allowed to become Prime Minister. Do you think they'll get what they want, the rail workers?
They've got a very strong case, and they've also, they are actually very difficult to, they're talking about bringing agency workers in. That's what Shapps is talking about. But it's not so straightforward. And there's also, I think some of the guy there was talking about when he was working on the railways, working in signalling, I think a lot of the signal people are coming out, more senior people. If they come out, the trains will not run. Same as the NACLs had come out during the miners' strike.
But, I mean,
they were the safety people.
I think the railway workers are feeling like they're boiled frogs, aren't they? Bit by bit, they're just being gotten rid of, their paying conditions eroded, erased, they're being taken for granted, whilst the people that the railways are really there for are the shareholders. This is something that Michael Hudson was talking about. We keep talking about Michael because he's such a key figure in understanding how these economy works. The railways are being financialised, and so the people with the power are taking every single penny they can out of it. And the workers, the people that actually do the work on the railways, are literally expendable. I mean, these are they're not even treated like human beings anymore.
What's extraordinary is that the privatised railway gets more subsidy from the government than the nationalised railway used to get. So in actual fact, it's not even an industry that makes money on its own terms. And of course, the big loss maker is all the commuter trains into London. You'd think that that would make a load of money, but it doesn't, because you've got to have a massive infrastructure going all the way out to Coleshilton and wherever, and it's only used twice a day. So the rail system has to be subsidised, otherwise you don't have a rail system.
Actually,
everybody around the world knows this, so the idea of having it run by the private sector is a non-starter.
This is another
really.
Thing that people don't realise, is that ever since the beaching cuts of the 1960s, the passenger transport has been subsidising the freight transport. So if you're a bulk freight transporter, that is to say an oil company, for example, you're not paying anywhere near as much per wagon or carriage or ton on the railway as the people who are actually passengers. So this is a whole inbuilt way of getting the public to be subsidising private industry.
Yes, I mean, well, it's rent-seeking in Hudson's terminology. And, you know, sensible countries don't do it. Yeah. If the railways in France are owned by the government, and there's no real danger even a right-wing government would change that. And, of course, the majority of the British public want a nationalised rail industry.
Well,
but we're not allowed to have it.
As he explained,
because
there,
the city of London doesn't... Well, it's happening. It's happened willy-nilly,
yes. We are
allowed
to have it. It's been happening because these train operating companies keep collapsing.
Yes, but at the same time, they're walking away with all the loot that they made. And you might as well say, hang on a minute, we're not just walking away, we want that money back.
It's not about running a railway, it's about making the loot and then taking off.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this is the way things are going, folks, in modern Britain, with the mess that these people are making of our infrastructure and the various rackets involved, you know, the racketeers dishing out to their mates the various rackets so that they can make a little fortune and make out that they're making the country better and whatever, because there's great share prices are going up. Actually, all that's happening is the wealth is being... raked off from the railways and put into the hands of private people who've already got plenty of money to buy shares with. So who's behind all this? Well, the Illuminati are behind it all, and I use that word advisedly, because only once a year we really get the people from the top of the top going to their Garter Day, they call it, which is the investiture of the Order of the Garter. Now, the Order of the Garter is the oldest chivalry organisation in the world. I think it was Edward II, Martin, I don't know if you can help
Edward
me out.
III.
Edward III, who initiated it not long after the execution of the Templars, funnily enough, just about 50 years after the Templars were arrested, etc. The Order of the Garter was set up, and it's been going strong ever since. Anyway, this is how the BBC's World Tonight covered it. Of course, the idea of Prince Andrew not appearing there completely swamped their coverage, so they covered almost nothing about it. So let's have a listen and see what the good old BBC had to say about one of the most important organisations in the country. People say it's just a whole bunch of people dressed up as knights, but actually, of course, they are incredibly powerful, this bunch.
Tony Blair and Baroness Amos were among those decked out in robes and plumed hats at the Garter Day ceremonies at Windsor Castle today. They're among the newest members of the Order of the Garter, which is the most senior royal order of chivalry. But one person who was kept away from public gaze is the Duke of York. It's been reported that Prince Andrew was due to play a public role in the ceremonies in his capacity as one of the royal members of the order. But he was forced to remain out of sight during the Garter Day procession after a family decision was taken to limit his appearance to the private aspects of the day's proceedings. There have also been reports that Prince Andrew is pushing for a return to royal duties, including asking to be reinstated as Colonel of the Grenadier Guards.
Interesting Garter Day with the Duchess of Cornwall
now joining that select group of people. Tony Blair, of course. Baroness Amos, the first British black to join the Order of the Garter. I described her as the first black member of the Order of the Garter, which is how the palace had described it to us.
So that was, at the end there, that was Richard Palmer from the Daily Express talking about the Garter Day investitures. And the BBC very quickly steering everything into talking about Prince Andrew, not really saying anything about the significance of who these people are, how long they've been around. Also about the, you know, being the oldest order of chivalry on the planet. But a family decision. Well, this is actually code for Prince Charles saying that he didn't want Andrew there in the public. Charles taking an increasing role in all of this. And this whole idea of Tony Blair, Martin, is a little bit concerning, isn't it? This Sir Tony Blair now. So now it seems that the more evil, wicked and dangerous you are, particularly by killing millions of people, making more millions homeless and starting illegal wars, makes you now a bit of a saint in terms of the British establishment.
Well, he's always been oriented towards the British establishment, so there's not really much of a surprise here, is there? And, of course, he's never going to be indicted as a war criminal under the current setup. Although, no doubt, he feels that, you know, he's pontificated about the Ukraine war with the usual yapping that you get from mainstream people like him.
ITV Tyne Tees did cover this quite comprehensively, although they didn't do a very good job on the... this is on Monday this week, by the way, on the main news. But Tyne Tees, because that's where Tony Blair's Sedgefield constituency was, did go big on it.
With royal pomp and pageantry, Sir Tony Blair was installed as a Knight Companion of the Most Noble Order of the Garter, honoured in recognition of his public service.
One, two, three, four, we don't want another war!
But just outside the walls of Windsor Castle, around 150 people protested, angry at him for taking Britain to war in Iraq.
We think it's an absolute disgrace that a man who lied to the people, misled Parliament, misled the cabinet to take us into a toxic and actually illegal war in Iraq should be given such an honour as this. It's just at the level of basic natural justice. It's a complete travesty.
I asked the former Prime Minister about his approach to Iraq and the backlash over his knighthood in an interview in April.
The only thing I ever say to people is that you can disagree with the decision, but it really is not fair to say the decision was taken on the basis of deceit or, you know, lies or whatever people say about it.
John Burton was Sir Tony Blair's political agent in Sedgefield for many years.
Of course there are people against the Iraq war, and he'll always have that. There's a lot of people think that the Iraq, it was the right thing to do. But the Queen, it just goes to show how strong she is in her beliefs. She realises that there was more to the Labour government than Iraq, and that they picked a lot of children out of poverty, they improved women's rights, Northern Ireland was so important.
We asked some people in Sedgefield today for their views on the former local MP being honoured.
Best Prime Minister we ever had. He was a lovely, lovely, lovely man.
I would probably say it's probably one of the best things. To give someone like that a knighthood.
I worked at the hospital at Winton, and he was a good friend of my dad, so, and I'm a big Labour man, so yes, I do, yeah.
No.
No! Knighthood? What for? Death.
Death and destruction, maybe. That's about it, yeah.
So in joining this medieval royal order, Sir Tony Blair has moved further still into the heart of Britain's modern-day establishment, but in the country at large, he remains a hugely divisive figure. Well, the Garter Day events here at Windsor Castle have now come to an end, as has the protest outside. A petition calling for Sir Tony Blair's knighthood to be rescinded has now drawn well over a million signatures after his honour was announced coming up 6 months ago. The palace had not commented on that. A reminder that members of the Order of the Garter are chosen personally by the Queen. It is a very select club made up of no more than 24 members, also including another former Prime Minister, Sir John Major. It dates back to 1348, when it was about senior figures surrounding the king. Nowadays, members don't really have any major ongoing role. It's about honouring those who've contributed to national life. Sir Tony Blair's contribution has certainly been very significant, both in the North East and far beyond, but his legacy remains a matter of real dispute.
So, yes, his legacy.
Well, I think the Iraq was obviously the thing that caused the most disgust amongst traditional supporters of the Labour movement. The Labour government did do some reasonable things in that era, but don't forget the Iraq war led directly to the rise of ISIS in Syria and the ongoing massacre in the Middle East. Completely the wrong thing to do. France and Germany didn't want to take part in it. They were right. And of course, it's caused all kinds of problems subsequently, which are still problems. And, those who think it was a good idea, like Sir Tony Blair, have got to accept that a lot of the refugees wandering around are a result of everything that we did in that era.
So what is this Order of the Garter? What's your take on it? Is it of any significance at all?
Well, it was originally set up to bind, nobles to the king. So it was part of the mystique of medieval kingship. And the fact that this carries on into the modern era, some would find that comforting, that all of these things carry on and there's all this continuity. But it's also quite significant that there's never been any change in any of these things. Jack Jones, who used to head up the Transport and General Workers Union, he was offered to become a Lord Jack Jones, and he just said, "Well, no, because people like me don't accept those kind of honours." Tony Blair isn't one of those kind of people, is he?
I mean, it does start to look rather toxic, this organisation, especially when you look at. The fact is, it's come out now that it was Prince Charles that didn't want Andrew around. He said that he thought Andrew might upstage Camilla at the Garter Days. Yeah, so this is apparently what Mirror and the Express and various others have been saying. Prince Charles didn't want Andrew upstaging Camilla at the Garter Day.
Well, don't forget, this is the Queen and her family's prerogative to decide who gets these honours. So it's not like, other things that they're recommended.
Petty of Charles to say, "I don't want Andrew around because he will upstage Camilla." I mean, God, I mean, it sounds to me as if he's a bit henpecked.
Well, I think the answer should be, of course, that why is Prince Andrew still a member of the Order of the Garter? Maybe that's the issue that needs to be addressed.
Is Andrew a member of the Order of the Garter?
Yes, he obviously is.
Not necessarily.
No, he is part of it because members of the royal family are part of it, and I believe he's one of them. That's what we heard earlier.
Mm. Well, he does go to these.
Yes, so in other words, he should be, maybe
Tony Blair. It's like a family squabble, really, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is. But, I mean, don't forget that the Order of the Garter historically was, it was the king or queen, mostly kings, who made these decisions, and it was to do with their personal power and prestige. And we live in a country where this still goes on, and we all tug our forelocks if we've got any hair and go, "Well, God bless them, isn't it?"
So you don't think they've got that much power, really? No. It looks like a cult. This is a cult.
It's part of the flummery that surrounds the British official state, and of course it is important because it covers up all of these networks of power and influence, which really do decide what goes on in the world, and decide things like peace and war and all the rest of it. So it's still the idea that there's nothing important in it. There is quite a lot of importance in it. It's a way, for example, for Blair to protect himself from, any comeback from the decisions he took.
All those retired High Court judges are sitting in there. They will make sure he's looked after, won't they?
Yeah, well, the establishment, as you know, sticks together. It's hardly a surprise that, call me unshocked. They've always done it. They still do it. What gets to me as a Labour Party member is how wealthy he's become, how ingrained into the establishment he's come. And his boy Ewan Blair is now worth more than he is, age 20-something. And I'm just thinking, this is the Labour Party.
Do you know how much Blair is worth now?
something like 60 million, isn't it?
50 million. Well, I mean, maybe you're right, Martin. Maybe you're a bit more up to date than I am.
There's the other 10 million that we don't want to talk about.
Anyway, it's also talked about the Order of the Garter as a cult, as actually the author Tim Cohen, who I've interviewed several times, talks about it as basically two covens. That is to say, two groups of 13 people all together running whatever it is they're running. But when people get initiated into it, you know, they are also, they have to keep quiet, very quiet about how these things are run. And I suppose traditionally, Martin, this is the sort of way that royalty has worked around the whole of Europe. It's not just here.
Yeah.
There are other orders of knighthood. I mean, there's things like the Knights of Malta.
Indeed.
People often think, oh, it's all just ceremonial. But when you're in, you're in. And you don't breathe a word of what goes on within the cult.
Well, that's true. These, you know, ruling classes are based around practices. And these, you know, the traditional ruling classes in the West preserve these practices as part of the glue that holds the ruling classes together.
The glue of this holding the ruling classes together is definitely not holding the rest of us together, as came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Many areas like mine have already had massive new housing development with no commensurate increase in general practice capacity. In one of my surgeries, with double the recommended number of patients per GP, a bowel cancer diagnosis of a 51-year-old father of four was missed and is now terminal. Getting this right is a life and death issue. So will the Prime Minister make sure that areas, that parts of the country that have already had massive new housing growth get the commensurate increase in general practice capacity that is only right and fair?
Prime Minister.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and of course we've increased the numbers of doctors by 6,000, another 1,200 more GPs since this time last year, 11,800 more nurses, but we must make sure that areas, particularly where areas of new sensitive development is going in, that there are the infrastructure services, particularly medical services, that they need. The NHS has a statutory duty to take account of population growth. I know he's met my old friend, the Health Secretary. I will take it up personally to make sure we get a proper approach to, I think, a very, very important issue.
Well, I mean, the National Health Service is in crisis as we speak. They were talking about ambulances lining up outside hospitals, unable to discharge patients. One obvious thing to do is massively increase expenditure on the health service, raise wages, and that way improve people's lives and the economy. But we've got Rishi Sunak who's counting the beans and saying, well, we can't afford to do this, can't afford to do that. And, of course, the national insurance increase was supposedly to deal with the social care crisis, but also to deal with the immediate crisis in the NHS. But a national insurance increase is an increase on a tax on the working poor. What you could have done is increase taxes on the wealthy. And the Tory party might be the only party that could turn around to the wealthy, comfortable people in this country and say, look, there's a war on. You're going to have to pay some more taxes. If the Labour Party says it, they'll scream that they're going to be sent to a
gulag. But they move all their money abroad, Martin. You can't tax
them. I disagree with you. When the crisis hits, Tony, managing the physical resources in your space is going to become absolutely essential. The obvious thing to do is people who say, I'm not going to... You assess every wealthy person who's a British citizen. You say, your wealth is this. You will pay. Of course, they never used to have income taxes in the Middle Ages with Edward III. Wealth taxes, the only kind of taxes. And you had to sell stuff to pay them. Yeah? The wealthy had to sell stuff to pay the taxes. Yeah?
That sounds like a much better system.
That's right.
When the crisis hits, what do you mean by that? Because I think it's quite useful just every now and again to take a step back from all this and say, well, this is actually what the crisis might look like.
Well... What will happen in certain parts of the world where they're already seeing what they've got to do, they will have things like the Russians have got capital controls. You can't just take your money in out of the country without being checked. And everybody said, well, they'll be able to take their money out of the country. In actual fact, all the sanctions on the Russian oligarchs, they've had to take all their money back into Russia to avoid it being stolen by the Western governments. And so that's a win-win from the Russian point of view.
So as this sort of international trade system starts to break down and wars start to happen, economic wars, questions need to be asked like this one. Can Britain feed itself?
David Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The conflict in Ukraine and the consequent disruption of the supply chain in wheat has highlighted the need for the United Kingdom to become more self-sufficient in food. The Genetic Technology Bill, which has its second reading this afternoon, will help create the conditions to enable English farmers to produce more food of higher quality. But does my right honourable friend agree that the drive to self-sufficiency requires a UK-wide effort? And will he urge the devolved administrations to adopt the provisions of the bill so that farmers across Britain can produce the food that the country needs?
Prime Minister.
My honourable friend is completely right that currently the policy, of course, the bill only applies to England. He's completely right. But in a loving and sharing way, we are going to work with the devolved administrations, Mr. Speaker, so that the whole of the UK can enjoy the benefits.
Isn't there an element in this Tory ruling class that would rather like to see the population starving so that they can do what they're told?
Well, you may say so, but you could. Others would say that's rhetoric. But this is about GMO crops, isn't it? GMO crops are banned in Russia. They've decided to go fully organic, and that's why their stuff, people want to buy it all over the world. The Chinese were going to be interested in GMO crops, but the Russians persuaded them not to go down the road. So we're going to find a situation. The Yanks have got GMO crops. They won't, and GMO crops from Britain will not be able to be sold in the European Union. They won't have it.
Frankenstein Foods.
Yeah. So it's all very well talking about we're going to be self-sufficient with GMO.
Isn't the main point of these isn't the main point of these Frankenstein foods that seeds can be produced which won't then produce any more seeds and that you have to go back to the seed companies?
That's right. It's all of that sort of stuff, yeah. And also, of course, it is, in fact, they don't know what the impact of it is. They just think they can make money out of it, so let's go ahead and do it.
Anyway, as the government implements all these things, you can imagine people thinking this is just a hostile environment for the whole population they're creating.
Well, it's actually a class war by the relatively powerful and wealthy against the rest of the population.
Yeah, which has been seen in many different guises over the centuries. And if you're starting to feel a little bit suicidal, we've got good old Bristol Labour MP Kerry McCarthy to help you out here as she popped up. I do try and listen to all of the Prime Minister's questions to make sure we get you every whatever is said by any of the Bristol MPs at those PMQs. And Kerry McCarthy, Bristol East, is it, Martin?
Yeah.
MP, this week was talking about suicide.
Kerry McCarthy.
Yeah!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We know that at times of economic hardship, suicide rates are likely to rise too. We saw that after the 2008 crash. So as well as doing more to support people through the cost of living crisis, will the Prime Minister commit to doing more to support excellent suicide prevention campaigns like CALM, the campaign against living miserably, and also implement Labour's pledge that anyone in need of it should be able to access mental health counselling within a month, an end to waiting lists?
Yeah, Prime Minister.
She's entirely right, Mr. Speaker, and we must focus ever more on mental health. That's why we're putting another £2.3 billion into supporting mental health services, including suicide prevention and the many wonderful charities that help people with their conditions, Mr. Speaker. And, you know, all I can say is it would be a good thing if across the floor of this House we had support for the spending that we're putting in.
I'm not sure the central government really cares about people committing suicide, does it? What evidence have we got for that? They seem to be driving people into economic conditions where suicide is more likely.
Yeah, but they also want to pretend to be nice guys. So let's all stroke each other's backsides. How caring we are about all of this, and you know how worried we are for people. Meanwhile, of course, we're making decisions.
A campaign against living miserably. What kind of thing is that to be?
Well, you can mock, but it's got a legitimate remit.
Well, I mean, to me, it seems that the whole direction of almost all government policies is to make sure people do live more miserably.
I think they would argue that they would argue the opposite, of course. But what they're actually doing is lining the pockets of their mates, defending the interests of the powerful, and if anybody gets in the way of that, well, tough. And in actual fact, Tory voters are much more kind of belligerent about this sort of thing than the Prime Minister there. They probably think that if these people want to commit suicide, let them go ahead. You know, what do we care? But that's the voters. The actual establishment politicians have to pretend that they've got some concern about it.
Another piece of news this week: pensioner 71 killed by an e-scooter in Rainworth. I think that's in Nottinghamshire somewhere, ridden by a 14-year-old boy. Just driving around here in Bristol, seeing these e-scooters everywhere. This is something that the Blairite Mayor Marvin Rees has been pushing as hard as he possibly can, saying that it's a solution for everybody, including, I suppose, pensioners, to get around the city. But you see these people just completely, you know, they shoot the lights, they're none of them have actually had any training. Well, some of them may have had, but there's no need for anybody to have had any kind of highway code training or anything. Yet here we've seen that these scooters can kill people if they just run straight into them.
Yeah. Well, it's deregulation, isn't it? Let's just do something which gives people freedom to have electric scooters. In actual fact, of course, the non-hire electric scooters are still illegal in Bristol. They see loads of them around. And, of course, what worries me is that people driving even an old-fashioned scooter or a motorbike with a provisional licence, say 16, 17, they can be quite a menace. But what you've got is teenagers who've got no road experience, driving things which can go quite fast, in and out of traffic. You know, it's a disaster waiting to happen, isn't it, in all sorts of different ways.
I just don't quite understand why it seemed to be some sort of great green solution where people are getting now starting to get killed with these scooters. Anyway, look, time for our break now. I know we didn't have it last week, but we're certainly going to have it most weeks. And we'll be back with one of our main stories anyway, which is reviewing this whole Paul Mason, the journalist who's been exposed as working with the security services to close down left-wing journalists to get their websites shut down, to do legal attacks on them, to basically bankrupt them, and this kind of thing. But also, very importantly, the fake vaccine ID system in Spain, where celebrities, top politicians, judges, etc., were able to buy fake vaccine passports. So they had no interest or wish to have a vaccine, but they could get themselves a free pass to say almost as if they had a vaccine. All that after the break.
darkness, we beseech thee, O Lord, and by thy great mercy, defend us from all perils and dangers of this night. For the love of thy only Son, our Saviour Jesus Christ.
So that's Jefferson Airplane playing us out there. That's a couple, actually. One is the Crown of Creation from 1968. I think rather terrific. The idea of these hippies actually talking about creation is rather wonderful, because of course we are the crown of creation. We're not just animals like a lot of people seem to think we are. And Greasy Heart, the second song there from 1972, don't change before the empire falls, you'll laugh so hard you crack the walls, says Great Slick. Before that, the choir of Salisbury Cathedral with Tell Out My Soul. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Just a little bit of info on our web stream. Some people may have found it difficult to find us this evening, but that's because Benoit at People's Republic of Stokescroft has just changed the page. I didn't realise he was going to do that, didn't tell us. But they've now got Long Throw Radio on the prsc.org.uk/radio page. And so if you were going to the PRSC site to find us, you won't. But actually the stream is exactly the same. The URL to actually find the web stream is the same. The actual web address is internet-radio.com/station/PRSC to go straight to the internet radio stream where we're streaming from. And I think over the next couple of weeks, I'm looking at making sure that we can keep it as the same URL each week. There is, I think it's possibly Talk Radio, which we'll use, which is a domain which will take you straight to the stream, whatever it is, and I can point that domain at the stream so that you can just bookmark that. And it's just a bit of a pity that we didn't know that the PRSC people had changed that page, so that if anyone's trying to find it via that page, they couldn't tonight. Anyway, obviously there's still most of you still listening here on the stream, and you've managed to figure that out. So Martin, the number one, I think, story this week is going to have to be the one I mentioned just before the news there, which was, what was it? Oh, gosh. Oh, that's right, this fake vaccine ID system. I mean, I find this unbelievable. Over in Spain, it's not unbelievable, it's true. Many questions apparently being asked, remaining over the false COVID-19 vaccination certificates bought by stars, sports personality and business leaders. This is on Euro Weekly News website. Reaction to the news that more than 2,200 prominent Spaniards, including the leader of one of the country's largest pharmaceutical companies, has been one of resignation and disbelief. Since the story broke on the 24th of May, people have been asking how this could happen. They've also been asking how it is that reaction to the news has been muted, almost accepting that this is what happens. In the words of one Twitter user, why nobody here talks about the Operation Jenna discovered in Spain? Why don't they go further in the investigation? So the idea here is that anyone rich and powerful who doesn't want to have a vaccine, or that thinks that maybe the vaccines are dangerous and cause more harm than good, such as Dr. Vernon Coleman, just gets a little certificate, they pay the money, and they can go around pretending that they've had a vaccine when they haven't.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an example of one law for them and another law for everybody else, isn't it? And the whole pandemic, plandemic crisis has demonstrated that in spades, hasn't it?
So whilst the average Spaniard did as the government asked, obeyed the rules, went out and got vaccinated, others thought they were above the law. They were somehow special. In a way, this is a kind of cult-like behaviour. It's almost like a kind of mafia thing. Well, certain people who are in the know the vaccines might kill you. And so instead of having a vaccine, they can just get a little certificate pretending they have.
Yeah, and of course, the purpose of vaccination, in theory, is that it protects other people, stops the virus from spreading. So people wandering around with fake vaccination certificates are not just cheating, they're also potentially, if what the mainstream tells us is true, and of course that's disputable, they're potentially killing other people. So it's not a harmless
well, that's
thing
right.
To do at all,
I mean, the article points out that many of these people are involved in professions that mean a high level of contact with others. Essentially, they care so little for those around them, they didn't bother to ensure that those they came into contact were kept safe and free of COVID. But perhaps the bigger issue, it says, is that the level of trust is broken. The company president involved in researching COVID vaccines didn't feel it necessary or important to get vaccinated, leads many to ask whether vaccinations were necessary or safe. So it could be, the whole thing could be a con. If the boss of the company pushing the vaccines doesn't want to have one, then surely, I mean, this is a massively important issue.
Well, I mean, obviously, we debated this at great length over the past few years. We know the Western pharmaceutical companies are bad actors. It's as simple as that. And of course, the argument is that these aren't really vaccines, that they are experimental technologies and so on. That doesn't, stop other vaccines. The Cuban vaccines, for example, are not produced under those political economy conditions. So that's another issue.
So how did they discover this? Well, it wasn't just through normal means. Enter policeman A, they say. His name has not been made public. According to the Guardia Civil, he made contact with an extremist Islamic group who he arranged to meet in France, but told them he personally could not travel as he hadn't been vaccinated. He said, "I don't have a COVID-19 passport. I'm not vaccinated. Allah does not allow me to put anything impure into my body." They replied that they could get him a passport and get him registered on the National Registry of Vaccination. So he was introduced to two Madrid residents, Alex, a former thief with a history of sexual assault, known to have contact with criminals in Madrid, and Irene, an attractive woman who'd been convicted and then pardoned for drug trafficking many years ago. The police followed the two and noticed that Irene met a young man twice a week after hours. The young man turned out to be Mario, a nursing assistant in the hospital at La Paz. A investigation online found that Mario was an active militant and COVID-19 denier, which made them suspicious. But they found they could not be the source of the false certificates, as he wouldn't have access to the database. So they went about pretending to be potential customers to gather the evidence they needed. What they found was another nurse was being given a share to issue the certificates, with the money being put into cryptocurrency accounts to try and hide it. But they also did spend it, drawing further attention to themselves, with the network growing and the number of customers increasing. In the end, the police arrested 15 people involved in selling and issuing these false certificates. Absolutely staggering. And I'll put a link to this article up on the web page, because I suppose in any area like this, you're going to get these, I mean, criminal organisations taking advantage, Martin. But what is so shocking is that people who are publicly saying, including the chief of the pharmaceutical company, that these vaccines are safe, are not prepared to take them themselves.
Well, it's very telling, isn't it? Obviously, I hadn't heard anything about this story before I came on tonight, so I'd need to know more to understand all the details.
So it's called Operation Jenna. It's called, was called. It's being shut down by the Spanish police almost by accident. And, of course, this is the sort of thing that may well be going on in the States, in other countries, not just Spain at all.
Well, quite likely. I mean, money talks, doesn't talk, it swears, as Bob Dylan famously said.
But it undermines the whole idea that these vaccines were properly tested safe, actually, I think, isn't it, next year? Yeah, it is, 2023, that the trials of these mRNA vaccines finish. So we're still in the trial stage.
Yes, and this issue is obviously a live issue and is still of concern. And we've debated it at great length in previous shows.
Over the last couple of years, yeah. Anyway, I thought, as a way of sort of going back to basics on vaccines, we should have a listen to a recent interview with Andrew Wakefield. I've always advocated that we should have a two-hour live TV debate between Bill Gates and Andrew Wakefield about vaccines and about the various programs over the years and how successful they have or haven't been. Because although Gates is the one with all the money, Wakefield, it seems to me, is the one with all the expertise and experience. So in this recent interview with Steve Kirsch, Andrew Wakefield, the so-called discredited doctor who made links between autism and the MMR vaccines. Here he is talking about the measles vaccine and how it was one of the first things that it made him realise that potentially these vaccines could be causing more harm than good here in London.
We published a paper in The Lancet which linked measles, single measles vaccine, to Crohn's disease. And it was on the back of that that parents then found someone they could go to who might listen to their story. But until that point, when they'd been to their doctors, the doctors had said, oh, no, no, your child's autistic, that, you know, that is just part of it. It's nothing to do with the vaccine. The vaccine's perfectly safe. So they'd found no one who was willing to listen. One of the most compelling aspects of the story for me as a gastroenterologist is that the children had intractable, severe gastrointestinal problems, pain, bloating, diarrhea, distension. They were failing to thrive. They, for all the world, looked like children with inflammatory bowel disease, which is exactly what they turned out to have. But medicine had dismissed all of these gastrointestinal problems. Your child has autism. It's just part of autism. Get over it. Put them in a home. Have another child. And it was an appalling situation. And so we put the autism to one side. We said, let's examine these gastrointestinal problems in their own right. When we did that, of course, the parents were right. The children had an inflammation. When we treated that, not only did the gastrointestinal symptoms get better, but the autism started to improve. And that was fascinating. The children started to use words that they hadn't used for 4 or 5 years. They started to interact. And that was the beginning of a very interesting journey.
It seems to me that this man, Andrew Wakefield Martin, was struck off for no other reason than he threatened profits of vaccine companies.
Well, I understand that is his contention, but you'll find that in the out there in the wider society, people do tend to trust experts and the self-regulation of those experts because they haven't got the sufficient knowledge to challenge what's going on.
They haven't enough informed consent. But anyway. Andrew Wakefield then goes on to explain what he thinks are the key things that doctors need to learn from the experience that he's had with vaccines.
The key learnings for people in the medical profession is go back to your roots, go back to your origins, have the humility to listen to your patients because they will tell you the origins of their problem. Mm. You will come to a better understanding. Number two, for mothers, please, please, whatever you do, trust that voice inside you, trust that mother's intuition, because it's there for an outstanding reason. It is the reason we are on this earth today, is because mothers know when their children are well and ill. They know what's good for them, what's bad for them. They know that intuitively. And the man in the white coat has tried to usurp that authority. I know your child better than you do because I'm a pediatrician. No, you do not. No one knows a child like their mother. So please trust in that intuition. When a voice tells you from inside, this is not right, then it's not right. And husbands, you don't have that intuition to the same extent, but please trust it. Trust the presence and the power of it in your wives.
I mean, when it comes to either taking or not taking something as simple as an MMR vaccine, obviously, Martin, there may be a conflict in the family between a mum and a doctor. A doctor giving one piece of advice, a mum, her gut reaction being, well, maybe this isn't necessary.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of dispute about this. But since it's a very technical subject, lots of people, and I would include myself in this, are agnostic about it because I don't know enough about it. I mean, saying that mothers always know more than doctors strikes me as a rather extreme statement.
I'll tell you what might inform
maybe
you.
Sometimes they do, but maybe sometimes they don't.
Let me tell you what might inform you a bit more, and that is if from 1984, the vaccine companies were indemnified against any injury that those vaccines might do to you.
I'm absolutely on board, as somebody with an economics background, that these companies are evil. Yeah, this stuff should be done just like the railways, just like the banking system, in the public sector where there is no profit motive. And then the decisions can be made on the basis of genuine scientific consensus.
There's no shareholders leaning on the backs of these various pharmaceutical people to push these to be accepted and also
it's quite clear
to capture the regulators.
Their business model is not to make people well. It's to sell drugs.
And make a meal, so they need to have more drugs.
Yeah. And you certainly don't want them cured. That's not... And people, I know people who've spoken to people who work in the pharmaceutical industry, and they openly say that's not what they're about.
Anyway,
and Jamie Dimon went to one of their meetings, I believe, and said, look, this isn't curing people. This is a hopeless business model. That's not what we're about.
Jamie Dimon, you mean? Yeah. Anyway, so Andrew, the final clip from Andrew Wakefield is where he talks about what he's doing about all this, which is making films.
I have made 4 movies now on this subject. They can be seen at 1986theact.com. The latest movie, which we can talk about, is my movie with Bobby Kennedy's Children's Health Defense, and that is Infertility, a Diabolical Agenda, an issue of infertility vaccines in developing countries, a resolution of that acrimonious debate that's been out there for a very long time and people will be aware of. So that comes out tomorrow. That's released tomorrow. It's for free. And if people go to infertilitymovie.org, O-R-G, infertilitymovie.org, and then later on, it will play on team1986.com, team1986.com. So
okay.
It's free. It's available. Please watch it. It's a compelling story. And so that's what I recommend, Steve, is now the purpose of what I can do, what I can contribute now, is take my knowledge and to distill it into films that allow people to watch in one sitting the background to it and make up their own minds. And it has been, has it been successful? Well, all I would say is that when I got involved in this 30 years ago, Steve, there were a handful, literally a handful of us around the world who were prepared to discuss issues of vaccine safety. Now, it is more than half the world. Largely, that's due to film. In great part, that's due to the silver lining of the COVID cloud, is that it has woken people up to issues of vaccine safety. But film, undoubtedly, films like Plandemic, which played to billions of people, played a major part in that. So film is an extremely effective way of bringing the truth to the public.
Yeah, but of course it won't be shown, will it? This new film of Andrew Wakefield's, Infertility, A Diabolical Agenda, on the BBC.
Well, it won't, well, no, but I mean, he's aware of that, and it, no doubt people will be able to watch it in other formats.
A film by award-winning filmmaker Andy Wakefield, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Children's Health Defence watch the chilling tale of African women whose fertility was stripped away through an experimental tetanus vaccine programme. Are women everywhere next? I rather like this. What is he saying? When they're through with Africa, they're coming for you, said Dr. Stephen Karanja. Of course, it's quite true, isn't it, that with the meningitis vaccine, Pfizer, for example, Africa was being used in this rather cynical white supremacist way by these pharmaceutical companies just to try out new stuff. And when it went wrong, they bribed officials and they bribed judges and tried to bribe their way out of it. In some cases, they succeeded. In other cases, they didn't.
Well, these pharmaceutical companies are part of the West's vampire squid sucking on the face of humanity, aren't they? What we need is socialized medicine, like in Cuba. Lots of things wrong in Cuba, but their healthcare system isn't one of them. And why can't we do that everywhere?
Infertility, A Diabolical Agenda is Andrew Wakefield's latest film, where you will learn, according to their website, infertilitymovie.org, the chilling, harrowing story of how a World Health Organization population control experiment, under the guise of a vaccination program, resulted in the sterilizations of millions of women in Africa without their knowledge or consent. Now, you would have thought that would be some interest to a journalist in London somewhere. No. How the ability to carry a pregnancy to term has been tragically stripped away from these women as their government attempts to cover up the evidence. About a brave Kenyan doctor, Dr. Stephen Karanja, who warned the world that once they're done with Africa, they're coming for the children and everyone else. Perspectives from leading experts expressing their concerns regarding other vaccines that could cause infertility in women around the world, including the COVID-19 shots. So, you know, this is very much a contemporary idea, and he's linking this to a kind of eugenics agenda, the idea of actually injecting people and causing them to become infertile deliberately?
Well, I think that there are clearly, I mean, people like Gates do have a eugenics agenda, no doubt about it. And of course, he's got no medical background whatsoever. So, you know, he clearly is somebody with both an ideological and financial agenda.
Anyway, now it's not COVID-19 anymore. What is it, Martin? It's monkeypox. And I spoke earlier this week to Kevin Trowell from Open Gloss. Now, Open Gloss is a new website, which is a kind of indie media thing for Gloucester and Gloucestershire. And he's been writing about various things. And I was quite interested to hear what is the origin of monkeypox. I saw, I think it was on the RT website, using the Tor browser. Of course, they try and block you like China. Looking at the Russian websites now, they were suggesting, Martin, I think, that monkeypox originated in Nigeria, in a US lab in Nigeria.
Yeah, I think this is the underlying story, and of course it came out in the when the Russian army seized the bio labs in the Ukraine, is that possibly both monkeypox and COVID have been created deliberately in bio labs by the US. That was DARPA, the Pentagon, who were funding the Wuhan lab, and it's basically an attack. It's a weapon of war, and the vaccines may also be part of it, like a double tap attack. But the idea that that COVID itself didn't exist and it's all in the mind, I think is wrong. I think we're basically, World War III has started. Millions of people have died of COVID. Possibly millions more are going to die of the vaccines, and they're all war casualties. Just like the people who died in the Spanish flu, which came from military facilities in Kansas, where they'd been injecting people with supposed anti-flu vaccines.
Anyway, Kevin has been quite prolific on the Open Gloss website. A couple of articles, I'll put links up to them on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. One is, will monkeypox be the next plandemic? Monkeypox, he says, is not a new disease. It's related to both chickenpox and smallpox, and generally of intermediate severity between the two. But he starts by talking about something I find just as interesting, which are these central bank digital currencies and the idea of programmable currencies, which are chugging down. Of course, the idea is that these would be the ones brought in after some kind of economic crash around the world.
It becomes more like a system of vouchers than money as we currently know it. If you think, say, like food stamps in America, you know, where there are heavy restrictions on what they can be spent on. They can only be used in certain shops. They can only be used for certain products. And the programmable nature of central bank digital currencies means they can be built to tie in with a carbon credit system, built to tie in with a social credit system, built to tie in with a rationing system, built to tie in with various other mechanisms, you know, like food stamps, to say what they can and can't be spent on, when they can be spent. You know, maybe it could be in times when they want to encourage spending, they can make them expire very quickly so people can't save. So these are all things that can be done with a digital programmable currency, which really can't be done with cash as it's currently understood.
Monkeypox. I think for many people, this is kind of another thing. It's just come up on the horizon after COVID-19. How dangerous is this?
It's unpleasant, but it's not, in most cases, it's not a life-threatening illness. I personally wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over it. In terms of where the monkeypox outbreak is going, monkeypox is not a new disease. It has been around 20 or 30 years. We've had sporadic outbreaks within those 20 or 30 years. So this outbreak, all things being equal, should be a nothing burger.
Was this made in a lab or not? What's the evidence there?
So there are all kinds of very suggestive hints in that direction. We've seen that the Wuhan Institute of Virology, where it's hypothesized that COVID came out of, actually built a part of a monkeypox virus from scratch. We've seen that by...
Hang on. They built it from scratch. They didn't modify an existing one.
That's correct, yes. The sequence, the gene sequence for monkeypox was assembled from scratch from a computerised model.
That's incredible. Can you just remind us of your headlines, of your articles, and whereabouts to find them?
It's the OpenGloss website, opengloss.co.uk, and the headlines of the two articles are What's Wrong with a Cashless Society? And Will Monkeypox Become the New Pandemic or Plandemic?
Okay, Kev, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
So, yeah, Kev. Thanks, Kevin. And so the two articles there are... The first one is What's Wrong with the Cashless Society? Cashless hurts the most vulnerable. The homeless will tell you that one of the biggest problems they face is so people carry cash nowadays. And the second one is Will Monkeypox Be the Next Plandemic? With brackets around the L. I suppose we should be trying to, we should deal with these one at a time, Martin, shouldn't we, really? Although they're both by Kevin. The first one, monkeypox. This is very worrying that someone can press a button on a machine and make up a virus like this.
Well, the stuff I've been reading about it suggests it's very odd is the way that it's simultaneously broken out in all developed countries, because it basically originated in Africa. So you wouldn't expect that. Ron Unz's stuff on Unz Review about COVID is also relevant to this, because he's assembled a massive amount of information that shows that COVID probably was engineered deliberately and deliberately released, not least Larry Romanoff's on there as well, is also a very good source for this stuff, is that the various different waves of COVID broke out in a very strange way around the world. In Iran, for example, it massively affected the top leadership immediately, and it didn't come from a port. And the actual version of COVID that they got was different from the Wuhan strain, which is why the Iranian Revolutionary Guard believe that it was a biological warfare attack on Iran after the assassination of Soleimani. And, of course, they carried out, you know, necessary measures, warlike measures, to deal with the war that was being waged on them.
Well, the I'll put links up to the monkeypox. Will monkeypox be the next pandemic? No, is the sort of short answer.
Well, apparently Bill Gates had they had a meeting where they war-gamed a monkeypox pandemic not that long ago.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I hope it didn't go very well. And also, What's Wrong with the Cashless Society? Two terrific articles from this Open Gloucestershire website. You know, why is it that our even regional, local or national papers cannot pick up on some of this excellent journalism? A cashless society is a disaster, as Kevin points out. And in a way, to pick up from a story we were doing last week now, last week we were discussing at length and did a tribute to, quite a long one, to Bruce Kent, the former chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, who died last week. And whilst I was, wondering really last week, is there still such a thing as the anti-nuclear movement? Yes, of course there is. There is such a thing as a peace movement and anti-nuclear movement. The two are kind of have some kind, lots of things in common. And actually, there was a whole load of stuff going on this week and a bit last week, mainly this week, up at the where our nuclear submarines are based, up at Coalport, up in the west of Scotland. And so earlier this week, I spoke to Roland Dye, not only about someone who met Bruce Kent, but also he was up there from the Bristol Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, protesting. And I wanted to know, what is he up to? Because, of course, it's not being covered in the mainstream press.
My name's Roland Dye. I suppose I've been involved in the peace movement on and off since the 80s. Bruce Kent was always one of those sort of main, characters involved in the peace movement and CND over all those years, well, for as long as I can remember, really. And I do remember, perhaps it was his last visit to Bristol. That's a few years ago now. He came to speak at Hamilton House.
Roughly 2015.
Yes, I'd guess. Yeah. He was doing a speaking tour. I realised what a lovely man he was, how sincere, and that this is a subject that's been, uppermost, close to his heart all his life, or all his active life, or as long as I can remember, which must be a few decades now. I mean, I joined the peace movement back in the 80s, like a lot of us did when those mass Greenham Common and Molesworth, all those mass demonstrations in London, which we thought somehow were going to stop all the nasty stuff, and they never did.
Well, maybe they helped to get some of these treaties signed by Thatcher and Reagan, Roland.
There was public pressure, and the women at Greenham, what an absolute milestone or epoch that was in campaigning history. Interestingly, last August, the 40-year anniversary reconstruction of the original march from South Wales to Greenham came through Bristol. So I think it was a four-day walk, substantial distances, and that's what the women from South Wales did in the first place. There was never a plan to set up a camp. They were just walking from South Wales, linking up with people along the way, these star marches, as they were called, going to Greenham Common to hand in a letter saying that they, as representatives of the women of South Wales, really didn't want cruise missiles being stationed in Greenham Common, which is near Newbury.
Okay, can you just take us through some of these specific places? You've mentioned Molesworth, Greenham Common. Why those bases were specifically targeted?
Certainly. So under Thatcher and Reagan, America was expanding its nuclear arsenal, and it wanted to place more nuclear weapons here in Europe, and cruise missiles were the early version of drones. So they were pilotless aeroplanes, basically, which could fly automatically, mapping the terrain, finding their way through the terrain as they flew, low enough to be under the radar. So hence they were a dangerous escalation in the uncertainty of what could trigger a nuclear war, and they could deliver either a conventional or a nuclear warhead onto a target. And that meant the enemy on the other side really didn't know what was coming. So they were in all ways a very dangerous and reckless escalation. So there were going to be a fleet of these stationed at Greenham Common. And the idea was these were mobile. They were mounted on trucks. They could be fired from trucks. And those trucks would, and I remember the phrase now, it's still etched onto my memory, melt away into the countryside. And what the peace campaigners did were to track these mobile launch vehicles and, expose where they were and hence, prevent them being rendered invisible.
Well, so what was the military's attitude, Roland, when people started actually driving their cars around and following these mobile cruise launchers?
I wasn't directly involved myself, but I've spoken to people who were. It was a game of cat and mouse. The soldiers didn't really know what they were doing. They didn't know what they were supposed to do. And peace campaigners popped their heads up around the hedge and shone torches on them and said, oh, look, it's here. It's not invisible after all. And there was a famous case where one of the vehicles, launch vehicles, actually slid off a road in the middle of winter on an icy road and ended up on its side in the ditch. Big embarrassment all round and had to be hauled back onto the road. It only had a nuclear warhead on it, nothing to worry about.
Yeah, so at least that Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which was these, I mean, we had these giant ballistic missiles in their silos, but these were maybe 2,000 mile range weapons that were mobile, and that meant that, for example, they could, be sitting there in a housing estate, and that housing estate could then become a target for the enemy's nuclear ballistic missiles or anything, really. I mean,
absolutely.
That was why, yeah, I think people got so aerated. But I mean, there were these treaties signed by Thatcher and Reagan after the early 80s and all the excitement about political action actually against the military about citing these things. But we're now in the situation where 2 years ago the US actually renounced this treaty, and the Russians obviously followed suit. Because they don't believe that the other side was playing ball. So we could be back where we were before the 1980s now, Roland.
Yes, it's truly shocking. Yeah, and that's what upsets me, because all my life I've seen how the West has tended to be the one that broke the treaties, upped the game, developed new technology, threatened the rest of the world, not just Russia, but the rest of the world, with our military superiority. American military spending alone is equal to the entire rest of the world, all put together. So that includes Russia, China, and all the other big nations as well. That has to be remembered. So talking to somebody here in Scotland, where I am at the moment, they say, well, why aren't you protesting in China? because at the moment they are not the aggressor. Their military spending is vastly less than Russia, than America. America's got nearly 1,000 bases all around the planet. It's absurd.
Well, I mean, also, I don't think you can protest in China, can you?
Well, that's another story, isn't it? And obviously, that's wrong. And you know, everybody should enjoy the same rights anywhere on the planet.
Well, I certainly agree with you there. Anyway, so you mentioned you're up in Scotland. What's going on up there?
We did a photo opportunity in Bristol on Monday the 6th in the morning, displaying our giant peace logo, which is mounted on the trailer. So it's the, many people would refer to it as the CND logo. It's painted interesting colours. It's parked next to me at the moment. So we left Bristol on Monday the 6th in the evening and basically did a sort of 3-day journey up to Scotland, stopping and visiting peace groups along the way, running public meetings and having photo opportunities in local towns. It was an amazing trip. We met so many remarkable peace campaigners here, there and everywhere, and they made us so welcome. It was really touching. And finally arrived in Glasgow midday on Thursday in time for a photo opportunity, and we had the head of Scottish CND there to make a speech and other, you know, wonderful people.
Okay, but you're now actually where the nuclear subs are, aren't you, at Coalport? Can you just give us an idea of, you know, what this infrastructure is still, these Trident submarines that are Britain's nuclear deterrent?
Well, certainly, because what upsets me and why I've come over to this side is I was trained as a nuclear scientist, did physics at university, and then went on to do a PhD. They teach you all this stuff, but in such a neutral, bland way, you never really switch your brain on and start thinking about it. It all starts with Aldermaston, which is down in the Newbury area. That's a vast factory that makes all the parts for nuclear warheads. They are then transported to Burfield, which you can see from the M4 as you drive past Reading Services. Yes, 1 mile south of the M4 near Reading. That assembles the nuclear warheads. Then they are put onto armed convoys and moved on public roads up the M1 or the M6, all the way up here to Scotland. And they arrive at a military base, which is a few hundred yards from where we're camped at the moment, called Coalport. And they will be stockpiling about 200 warheads in this facility here up on the top of a hill. And I'll stress that each of those warheads is about 8 times the destructive power of the ones that were used on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. That's a colossal explosive power here, 40 miles from the centre of Glasgow and as the wind blows. So it's not very popular in Scotland. The submarines will come in and out of Coalport to be loaded or unloaded. Then they go around into the next lock and they go into a harbour which is called Fast Lane, which is a place that perhaps a few people have heard of. Both these sites are deeply unpopular here in Scotland. It's all part of the independence movement. They're seen as English nuclear weapons. They're foisted on the Scots because they could be dangerous, couldn't they? They could be nasty. Something terrible could go wrong. And, it, you know, why aren't they in England?
Well, of course, the other thing is anywhere these weapons are becomes a target for foreign nuclear attack. And so it's almost as if you've got a little beacon on top of your town saying, please nuke us, because we've got loads of nukes here. But so what would you say, though, to, I mean, there are, you know, quite a lot of people out there, Roland, who would say, well, actually, because of this whole idea of mutually assured destruction, in a weird way, nuclear weapons have actually kept the peace since the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, I got very stuck on the word defence. You know, it's called the Ministry of Defence. The word defence is the most powerful weapon in the propaganda armoury that the government used against us, because surveys have been done where they classify military spending into different groups. It could be defence, it could be general purpose or offence. 3/4 of British military spending is offence. Take it from me, we don't need an giant aircraft carrier which can power its way halfway around the planet to patrol the China seas to defend the Dover Straits. That is not defence, that is offence. And British military power projection on a global stage, you can read the sort of propaganda on the various military websites. That's what they're doing. They're reaching out and basically controlling and threatening the rest of the planet. And that's wrong. I believe in defense. My old mother actually volunteered for the army in 1939. She worked a switchboard in the British Army. She did her bit to defend this country when it did seem to be under a threat of imminent invasion. But that's not what we're facing now.
So that's Roland Dye there, speaking to me earlier this week from Coalport and Faz Lane. One of the things that he did point out was that there is still a peace movement, Martin, going on in this country. It's just not really being reported anymore.
Well, that's right. I think one of the things underlying the Ukraine war that people have to understand is that the Russians, in their demarche before you know the latest hostilities, were saying we were not willing to accept short-range nuclear missiles in Europe which can carry out a first strike on Russian territory. Poland and Romania are agreeing at the moment to put such missiles on their territory, and the Russians are saying we're not going to accept that, any more than the US accepted similar missiles in Cuba in 1962. And Zelensky was saying that the Ukraine should have had nuclear weapons, and then you enter the theatre of the absurd when you talk about this, because of course if Ukraine had had nuclear weapons, it wouldn't have made any difference at all, because if Ukraine had nuked Russia, you'd also be effectively nuking the Ukraine because they're so destructive. The only real use of nuclear weapons is to target a very long way away from where you are. If you try and nuke somebody nearby yourself, it's just a suicide bomb.
It's almost as if you have to go now to Peace News to get a subscription or whatever to Peace News or something in order to find out what's actually going on, because these are the sorts of things that used to get at least a line in the news. Not anymore, though. Police are apparently now denying heart medication to one of the activists taking part in a camp at Coalport. The Faz Lane Action for Bomb Ban, which is part of Extinction Rebellion, has led to at least four arrests outside Coalport, the Royal Naval something, RNAD Coalport, the nuclear warhead storage facility in West Scotland. At least four people have been arrested amongst many actions this week at Camp in Peaton Wood in Western Scotland. According to the FAB organisers, one of the arrestees was deprived of her heart medication for 9 hours by police and threatened with being held overnight with no access to medication. The FAB camp is very close to RNAD Coalport in Western Scotland, which holds the nuclear warheads for Britain's Trident missiles. These missiles are carried by Trident submarines based at Faz Lane in the neighbouring Loch. Among other actions from this camp, four activists managed to canoe into Coalport's waters, and one woman actually landed on Coalport's beach and planted a CND flag on MOD land.
Well, I mean, these protests have continued for many decades, and as long as the nuclear submarines are there, no doubt they will continue to take place. The interesting thing is, as pointed out by Roland, is an independent Scotland, as it's pretty clear that they will say that they'll have to go. And the British,
if they can.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see whether they can do that. One of the main reasons
for this camp was it was set up to publicise the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and to record opposition to UK threats of nuclear mass destruction. Trident Ploughshares, the main organisers of the camp, supported by Women Greenham Everywhere and other groups. Five women from the Women Greenham Women Are Everywhere poured fake blood on themselves and carried out a dye-in, blocking the main gate to Coalport. I mean, these things are still going on. In fact, there's quite a lot going on out there. One of them, in Peace News this week, is about the threat to bring US nuclear weapons back to the UK, to Lake and Heath in Suffolk.
Well, we're probably closer to the potential for a nuclear war by accident or design than we have ever been. And, of course, people have... What's long people...
Do you think maybe the Americans have been keeping those nukes there without telling us?
Well, how would we know? The B-52 bombers based at Fairford flew along the whole Russian border last year. Being intercepted. I sent you the video of the intercept by the Russian.
Yeah, it was
Russian
an excellent. It wasn't actually really too. I mean, what the Russian fighter did was it actually flew, did a quite a nifty maneuver in front of the B-52 bomber, which led to quite severe turbulence inside the plane. So you could see the flight crew of the B-52 being bounced around by the fact that the Russian aircraft had been flying in front of them.
Yeah, and if you can imagine, if a Russian bomber had flown along the east coast of the United States, just outside the territorial waters, they would have gone absolutely mental. And the fact is that we do exactly that to the Russians, and the Russians are saying, for goodness sake, back off.
But at the end
but
of
we
the
haven't
day,
really understood how serious it is until the Russians say, right, we've talked to you and you're not listening, now we're going to
at the
war.
End of May, USAF Lake and Heath, they call it, although of course outside it says RAF Lake and Heath, it's quite nice to see them actually using this US Air Force base terminology to refer to these, 150 activists from all around the UK and even coming over from the continent joined a CND demonstration at Lake and Heath. The news what that the US Air Force might be returning nuclear weapons to its base in North Suffolk broke on the 11th of April with a tweet from Hans Christensen, a US researcher. It says, looks like RAF Lake and Heath Air Base has quietly been added to the list of nuclear weapons storage sites receiving upgrades in Europe.
Well, this is the preparation for a potential nuclear war. And, of course, the ripping up of the Intermediate Forces Treaty, the Intermediate Missiles Treaty, well, it's just outrageous. I mean, Gorbachev, it wasn't Thatcher. Thatcher has nothing to do with it. It was Gorbachev and Reagan who signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty because Britain didn't have any intermediate
maybe,
nuclear
maybe
forces.
Maybe Margaret
anyway.
Was gnashing her teeth, do you think?
Well, I think she was just told what to do by the Americans. She just said yes,
and
sir.
By Victor Rothschild most of the time.
But, I mean, in any case, that was an absolutely rational thing to do. There is a basic geographical imbalance between Western Europe and Russia, who are quite close, and the United States on the other side of the world. So the Russians have got a legitimate concern that because you've got your nuclear weapons right up in our base, that there is going to be a first strike that we won't be able to predict.
Do you think the Americans will get their war in Europe?
Well, they've got one. It's already raging.
Oh, certainly, they've certainly started something. Anyway, on Russia Today, as I mentioned earlier in the show, I do try and dip in there, and I would suggest you folks do too at home. In the evenings, I think it's around about 8, 9 and 10 p.m., they do still do news bulletins, and you pick up some quite interesting stuff on there, including the Russian ambassador to London, Andrei Kellin, where here he is introduced to begin with, and then he starts explaining his response to what Zelensky is saying, the Ukrainian president.
President Zelensky has praised London's military assistance to Kiev during a visit by the UK's defence secretary to the Ukrainian capital. Zelensky also took the chance to plead for another batch of weapons from Britain.
Ukrainian troops are doing everything they can. Using the artillery, they have to stop the occupiers' offensive, well as much as the heavy weapons and modern artillery. All that we have asked and continue to ask our partners to provide, allow them to. I have met the UK Secretary of State for Defence Ben Wallace. We discussed how to stop Russian aggression, and how to stop it mounting a potential offence, and what supplies are needed for our army. The British show true leadership in defence matters.
Britain has now confirmed a new shipment of long-range rocket launchers, and that's in addition to thousands of anti-tank missiles, armoured vehicles and air defence systems. The head of Ukraine's military intelligence has recently said that the country's troops have almost run out of ammunition and now rely on Western supplies. Russia's ambassador to the UK, Andrei Kellin, doubts whether London will be interested in supporting Ukraine when the conflict eventually ends.
It prolongates the conflict. It makes Ukrainian soldiers continue fight. It is very cynical, I should say, because Britain is providing money, not much, but it is providing weapon, and it enforces and encourages Ukrainian army to continue fighting. And no single knowledge about or single idea about the future of Ukraine. What's going to happen after that? It's an interesting question. Whether UK will be interested after the conflict in rebuilding Ukraine, in continuing owing money to the authorities in Kiev that proved to be very inefficient in building up the country and handling country's economy once again in doing something constructive. So I'm afraid the interest will be lost in some sort of it, if there will be a failure to continue to make such a project as an anti-Russian to construct out of Ukraine an anti-Russian state, and it will be no more capabilities and no more possibility to do that, then probably it will be less interest than now.
Well, that's the Russian ambassador to London, Andrei Kelin, spelling it out, really. He's saying, well, they're all getting very, very enthusiastic at the moment for Zelensky and Ukraine, but once the war is finished, he says that they probably just will ignore it. They might want some contracts to rebuild the place, but then they'll be gone.
Well, I mean, obviously, we may see the war end before the end of the summer, because the Ukrainians are at a tipping point where they may simply collapse. And, you know, it's interesting that not just Kissinger, but what's his name? The Austin, the head Secretary of State for Defense, phoned Shoigu and said, you know, we want a ceasefire. And they're suggesting now maybe we're going to bring the war to an end, and there'll have to be some kind of negotiation. Zelensky at one stage was negotiating and prepared to talk to the Russians. Now, because of all this encouragement from people like Boris Johnson and Ben Wallace, he thinks he can fight to the finish and win, which is absolutely absurd. And the war will drag on for a bit longer as a result of this idiocy. But I don't think there's any doubt about what the outcome's going to be. The Russians are going to partition Ukraine, just as the Western NATO powers partitioned Yugoslavia, and for exactly the same reason, because nobody can stop them.
Right, interesting. Anyway, so I think it's quite interesting to hear a kind of untrammelled interview with the Russian ambassador, rather unlike the one we had last week with Clive Myrie. And here he is again, Andrei Kelin here, talking about some actually much more serious issues, which are something called Operation Orbit, he says, which was the British operation to prepare Ukraine for war with Russia, which in the run-up to this particular conflict, which started in February. I think he makes some very interesting points about what the British have been doing in Ukraine, has been actually just trying to basically egg Ukraine on to have a war with Russia.
Of course, we have seen that Western powers were preparing Ukraine for for the conflict by supplying arms during many years before the conflict. United Kingdom has specifically maintained Operation Orbit to prepare military people from Ukraine for this conflict as well. And also UK has started to construct two naval bases on the coast, one in Berdyansk and the other in Nikolaev. Of course, we have seen all these preparations that has been done to encourage Ukraine for a conflict. So in certain way, it is that they have meddled into it. And of course, at the moment, I think that they are preventing any kind of moves that have been born inside Kyiv for negotiation. So far, they are continuing to push Ukraine along the same way to continue fighting. Not to think about the future. The longer conflict will last, the weaker situation in Ukraine will be. So more concessions Ukraine should do if it will prolongate for more months ahead.
Well, that's right. I mean, before the latest intervention by the Russians in the conflict, they basically said to the Ukrainians, we've been saying to you for 8 years, you need to negotiate with the breakaway republics. One last time, will you negotiate? And the Ukrainians said,
well, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that they didn't have no intention of doing it. In fact, they did have an intention, Martin, of starting the war in the first place.
Well, the reason why the Ukrainians were about to try to invade the Donbass.
They wanted to lure the Russians into this conflict, and the Russians have, I think, with open eyes, gone into it and said, okay, we're up for it, because we're not afraid of this now. And not afraid of you, because all the time that, you know, you've been negotiating with us over the last 20, 30 years, actually 20 years pretty much, we've been making sure that we have the ability to fight you and win.
That's true, but that's in relation to the West in general rather than the Ukraine.
What about this
regime?
Operation Orbital, though? This is more interesting, isn't it, in a way, is that the British, for example, we were apparently, I didn't know this, we were training 10,000 Ukrainian troops every 120 days over there.
Yep, and many of those Ukrainian troops were in the Azov battalions, who are openly neo-Nazis. So your taxes have been used to send British Special Forces, SBS, SAS, Royal Marines, over there to train neo-Nazis to kill Russians in the Donbass.
But the reason the British were over there was to train the Ukrainian armed forces after the illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014.
They've been backing up the Ukrainian regime, even when it didn't have a democratic mandate after the initial coup. And they've been, the British Special Forces in intelligence services have been embedded, deeply embedded within the Ukrainian military, which is why, you know, it's quite possible that there's still British Special Forces inside the Donbass cauldron who are going to end up as, well, are they going to be prisoners of war? Britain isn't at war with Ukraine. With Russia officially, so maybe they won't even get to, if they're captured, they can't expect Geneva Convention status, can they?
So anyway, in the penultimate clip from Andrei Kellin on RT, on the news, the bulletins, which just run on there, 8, 9, 10pm in the evenings, if you want to find them on Odyssey. The Russian ambassador talks about the way that the West, and maybe before we hear this, Martin, you can comment yourself as well. A lot of the equipment, the artillery particularly, which has been being supplied to the Ukrainian army by the NATO countries, has been used to kill civilians.
That's right. The latest stuff, the 155mm cannons that have been sent there, are being used to shell indiscriminately civilian targets in the Donbass, and they've killed quite a few people.
Well, that's where your taxpayers' money's going, folks.
Some of this weapon that has been supplied to Kyiv has been used against civil population in Donetsk, in Lugansk. We have seen already the results of shelling by French artillery, the destruction of houses and kill of civilians. Only last week, I think it's about 80 civilians has died because of this shelling. And the more weapon that has been chosen for that, that's exactly was this artillery that has been supplied over there. I do not even mention that it is in contradiction with the basic principle of non-supplying of arms into the zone of conflicts. Unresponsible behavior. This is one of the principles which is guided. European Union is guided by never supply weapons to the zones of conflict. And as you understand, it is used not only in for the military purposes.
You know, the evidence is overwhelming that that's what they've been doing. I think they've been. You've got to understand that the mentality of the Ukrainian military is that the Russian-speaking civilians in the Donbass are traitors, and therefore their lives, you know, they're traitors to Ukraine, and they're trying basically to drive the population out. Several million people have fled from the Donbass to Russia, and that happened in the earlier stages of the crisis in 2014. The Western Ukrainians, who are now, you know, turning up in this country and so on, haven't actually seen any fighting at all until this latest round. It was all happening somewhere else. But British Special Forces and our military have been deeply embedded in this crisis from the beginning. I suspect their hand in the assassination of Zakhachenko, who was the elected Prime Minister of Donetsk, and that was quite possibly our boys or girls or whoever it was who did it, probably boys. But the fact is that's a criminal act. That's a criminal act. The assassination of elected politicians in other people's countries is a criminal act, and it's an act of war. And ultimately, of course, we could end up with a situation where if Britain gets lured into a conflict directly with the Russians won't declare war. They will just hit targets inside Britain without warning.
Well, the final clip from the Russian ambassador, Andrei Kellin, he talks about, well, we don't even really need to hear it, so I can sum up what he's saying, is that he's saying that what's happening is actually the Russians have intervened in a civil war. This isn't really an invasion at all.
That's right. I mean, we intervened in a civil war in Yugoslavia. There was no UN resolution backing it. The Russians would have vetoed it, but we went round it because Tony Blair invented the concept of R2P, responsibility to protect. Now, 14,000 and more, mostly civilians, have been killed in the Donbass since 2014 by the Ukrainian forces. Everybody in Russia sees this nightly on their TV, yet more people being shelled by the Ukrainians. And any government in Russia would be under enormous pressure to intervene to protect Russian speaking civilians.
Let's face it, though, Martin, the Ukrainians have been very spectacularly successful in holding the Russians up in Severodonetsk, haven't they?
No, they haven't.
Yes, they have.
No, that
yes,
they say they have, because don't forget, well, everything they say
weeks
is based...
they've been fighting in Severodonetsk, well, they've got nowhere.
Well, no, the point is, what they're doing is like ISIS in Syria, and don't forget, the Russian army has been fighting ISIS in Syria, which we have also been supporting. The Syrian Arab army has taken over 100,000 casualties, defending their country against our aggression against them. What is happening in Severodonetsk is they are embedding themselves in civilian-controlled civilian areas, which makes it very hard for the Russian military to get them out without killing loads and loads of civilians. Same in Syria. And what they did in Syria and what they've been doing all along is you surround them, you try and starve them out,
they
try and negotiate.
They've surrounded Severodonetsk.
They've surrounded... what's left in... what's happening in there is that they are still... it's like the Azovstal plant in Mariupol. They're in the industrial zone.
They're in the chemical plant, aren't
yeah,
they?
That's right. And they've got several, at least 1,000 civilians are being held as hostages by the Ukrainians. And the other morning, the Russian military opened up corridors for these civilians to leave the plant. And they, as they tried to do it, they were shot down, as what happened in Mariupol. Same thing happened in Syria. Now, that's very difficult from the Russian army's point of view.
Well,
they could just flatten the place,
I mean, I've also
kill everybody.
Heard, I mean, I don't know if it's true, Martin, but I've also heard about Ukrainian soldiers surrendering to the Russians, then being shot in the back.
Yes, but by their own side. Yeah, because they've got blocker, just like in World War II, they've got blocker battalions behind the front rank. And the blocker battalions are all drawn from the Azov wing of the army. Yeah, so you've got
so you're not fighting at the front line, but if the people on the front line think, well, actually we've lost this, we need to surrender,
or even try to, retreat. And of course they're using the civilian population in Donetsk and Luhansk as human shields, because they're Russian speakers who voted to leave the Ukraine in 2014.
We leave Ukraine,
and therefore traitors according to the mentality
before we leave
of the Ukrainian
chatting
nationals.
About Ukraine, the Russian RT has been brilliant on all this. We can hear finally from someone you hear on this show from time to time, Scott Ritter, a former US Marine Corps intelligence officer, talking on RT about how the shares in the arms company are rising so fast in America.
Washington is sending 6,500 Javelin anti-tank missile systems, which are made by Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. The cost of each missile is about $78,000, and the reusable launcher is another $100,000. Ukraine will receive more of these systems from France and Estonia, with another 200 coming from the UK.
Well, here you can see how the share prices of some defense giants have risen as investors anticipate rising profits. U.S. contractor AeroVironment is expected to be one of the biggest beneficiaries, along with European companies Rheinmetall and Leonardo, whose shares have risen by 120 and 67% respectively. However, former Marine Corps intelligence officer Scott Ritter says Western weapons supplies will not change the outcome of the conflict.
Ukraine is not getting the benefit of the new production. Ukraine is receiving weapons that have been in storage, older weapons. But as these are moved out of storage, that creates a gap in Western capability that needs to be filled by new production. And so these companies are being asked to produce weapons, none of which will go to Ukraine, all of which will go to fill the armories of their respective nations. But no, this is a windfall for military-industrial corporations. The situation is deteriorating. The best the supply of Western arms can do is reduce the rate of deterioration. It will never reverse the outcome. No amount of Western weaponry will enable Ukraine to gain the upper hand. All it will do is lengthen the conflict and, more importantly, from the Western perspective, kill more Russians, because that's all this is about. We heard that from Lloyd Austin, the American Secretary of Defense, who said that the goal here is to make Russia pay a cost, to inflict pain on Russia. That means dead Russians. And so that's what the West is trying to accomplish here. And it's very cynical, because it's not just Russians that are dying. As we said, for every one Russian that goes down, you know, maybe 20 Ukrainians are going down. So it's about dead Ukrainians as well. And maybe it's time Ukraine wakes up and understands that the West is seeking to extend this conflict, not to help Ukraine.
Well, that's absolutely correct, obviously. And it's very refreshing to hear, you know, this retired US military officer, Douglas McGregor, Lieutenant Colonel Douglas McGregor, people can pick his stuff up on the internet, also very good on this. It's disgusting. The West has basically ruined Ukraine. Ukrainians should wise up and realise that they're just being used, and that in actual fact their best interests are not being served by any of this.
Well, the real danger in Ukraine, of course, is that some of the other conflicts around the world will be quietly being ramped up. And you see this week, US has secretly been approving Israeli airstrikes in Syria. The Syria farmers struggle due to US-backed Kurds' ban on wheat sales. And also Israel's Damascus airport strike heralds a new phase in the conflict. The drones are attacking a US-backed Syrian rebels in a US base. So, I mean, in Damascus airport being attacked, this is reported in Middle East Eye, Martin, is paralysing travel and heralding a new phase of the conflict, says Middle East Eye. Syria vows to have the airport operational again, but the Israeli attacks are aimed at stymieing Iranian proxies are likely to continue. So this is all approved by the Americans, according to antiwar.com. The Israelis blasting away at Damascus, which, of course, the Americans failed to take back, what, 4 or 5 years ago?
The, what could happen is that the Ukraine crisis, the fighting in the Ukraine, won't be contained to the Ukraine. It could easily spread into the Middle East. And don't forget, the Russian military are embedded with the Syrian military inside Syria, and they're facing off with the Israelis on the Golan Heights. So the whole thing, you know, we're reaching a point where, and of course the Russians, before their intervention in the Ukrainian civil war, if we can call it that, it's not an invasion, that's what it is, it's an intervention in the civil war, they also pretty much guarantee, you know, they realised that they would probably be taking on the whole of the West and not just in the Ukraine. So they've got all sorts of other pressure points.
Shortly
that
after dawn on the 10th of June, Damascus International Airport was bombarded by Israeli missiles, leaving three huge craters in each of its two operational runways. Syrian Civil Aviation Authority issued a statement confirming the closure of runways 23R and 23L, citing a WIP, work in progress, with the estimated reopening date set for 10 days later on the 20th of June. Syrians awoke to find their flights were diverted, cancelled, as the Syrian Airways fleet was immediately grounded, adding more strain to the country's war-battered aviation industry. Since the Syrian civil war in 2011, Israel has carried out hundreds of airstrikes against Syria. They're basically just doing the US's dirty work for them, just like we're doing with Assange.
Yeah, well, they've got their own reasons as well to fight the Syrians, not just they may be more belligerent than the US, although it's difficult to tell the difference. I mean, all of these conflicts have been building for a long time. People thinking that this all started in February with the Russian intervention in Ukraine have missed the point.
Well, the Syrians are obviously sucking this up. Well, how long can they suck it up, and how much can they suck up?
Well, ultimately, what the Israelis have to confront is that they may be taking on the Russian armed forces, and they're actually quite a small country, and they could easily be isolated. Yeah, could you imagine a Russian naval blockade of Israel? It's not going to happen in the short run, because the Russians are not reckless. They're not looking for trouble. But ultimately, they're preparing to fight on every level. The Russian leadership and the Russian people have now reached the point where they realise that their vital national interests are at stake, and they are not going to back down. And they've also got the means to fight, unlike other adversaries of the West in recent decades. In actual fact, just think of all the training that was involved for the Russian armed forces intervening in the Syrian conflict. And they, of course, are actually winning, unlike the British army, kicked out of Basra and Afghanistan and Helmand province, completely defeated by the local boys. They are good, we are crap, and that's going to tell in the end.
Okay, so just to wind up this week, looking at the cult of the Order of the Garter, and comparing maybe Windsor and Wevelsburg. Here is Tim Cohen, author of The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, looking at Prince Charles as the Jewish Messiah and also the Muslim Mahdi. Amazing how he's managed to get himself ready for both roles.
Unlike other world leaders, it's been announced in Israel on national television more than once that Prince Charles is a descendant of King David. While that's true of William and Harry as well, for example, so that's one criteria that the two of them would meet, unlike the other criteria that pertain to his father in relation to the Antichrist, You don't see that announcement, and I haven't heard of that announcement for any other world leader, just Prince Charles. And the only way that announcement could be made on national television in Israel is if there's a rabbinic community behind it who are looking at the British monarchy potentially as the source of the Messiah, because obviously they reject Jesus, Yeshua, as the Messiah, most of them. You know, I'm an exception, right? I'm a Cohen by birth, meaning I'm a descendant of Aaron, Moses' brother. I'm a Levite. I believe there are, you know, a couple hundred thousand people like me in the world who are Israelites who do. But most of Israel still does not believe, including Israel in the land. And yet, so they're looking for somebody to be the Messiah. They think this is the time in history soon when the Messiah has to show up. Many rabbis do. And so this announcement's been made for Prince Charles in Israel. That's a big deal. And until recently, meaning the last few years, Prince Charles had never visited Israel in a formal capacity, only informally, for example, to see the grave of his grandmother. You know, she's buried in the Mount of Olives, or that kind of thing. For Shimon Peres's funeral, for example, because Peres was knight of Prince Charles and involved in this false peace process type thing. But not too long ago, at a Holocaust remembrance type event, a big deal one, in Israel, world leaders gathered to give speeches on the Holocaust. And that was Prince Charles' first formal visit to Israel. And he gave, flat out, one of the best speeches ever on the subject of the Holocaust, you know, and denouncing it and so forth. The person who gave the next best speech after Prince Charles, oddly enough, was Vladimir Putin, if you can believe that. And so Prince Charles really ingratiated himself to the nation of Israel with that speech. And people can look that up online. It was actually a really big deal, and it was a fantastic speech. So that being said, the really weird thing is that right after that speech, Prince Charles skipped all the group photos. The other world leaders participated, including the other speakers. Prince Charles skipped them, and instead, he went to meet with Abbas and the so-called Palestinians to push the fake peace process and the division of Jerusalem. That's what he did immediately following his speech. So he went from ingratiating himself to the Israeli populace to literally stabbing Israel in the back and pushing the division of Jerusalem. Prince Charles has an honorary doctorate in Islamic studies from a university in Cairo, Egypt, which is actually the most prominent seat of Islamic learning in the world, Sunni Islamic learning. So he has a doctorate in Islam. He is the most prominent Westerner from the entire world, among the Muslim Middle East. And he is a Muslim converted under one of the guardians behind the scenes. And, oh, by the way, he's also an Hashemite, same lineage as Jordan's King Hussein in that sense, meaning he supposedly descends from from Islam's prophet Muhammad. All that adds up to one thing, which is that Prince Charles could step in one day and say, I'm your Mahdi, to the Muslim world, to both Iran and Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Muslim world. Besides, this rabbinic community behind the scenes in Israel looking at him potentially as the Messiah.
Well, I don't think Prince Andrew thinks of him as the Messiah. Anyway, especially after messing him around this week, making out that he could be part of the procession and then changing his mind, saying, no, you can't. Obviously, the point of that was to just obscure the whole ceremony of the Order of the Garter, the initiations into the Order of the Garter, ordered by the Queen. And the idea that we've now got this, that Blair is in there and Carmilla, the original vampire, in there too, I think it's pretty obvious what's going on. This is just another Vevelsberg that they're creating at Windsor Castle. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to sound engineer Dave Bozanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via the Not the BCFM Politics show page. We'll also find the podcast full-length interviews, story links, comment page, our email addresses. And also you can join my Telegram channel, Tony Gosling Censored channel, and pass on some story links on there too. So I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. The website is thisweekoneword.org.uk. my paperbacks about deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war. That is the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem. That costs £15. And it's called The Traitors of Arnhem. Also, my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination. The Siege of Heaven Reader, both on eBay, and the Siege of Heaven ebook, and links to all of them are via www.bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. Actually, this is really the internetradio.com/stations/PRSC, because we're no longer on the People's Republic of Stokescroft website as of this week. It'd be nice if they told me that. Anyway, except we are restreaming on the Richie Allen Show sometimes as well on this stream, and over Sunday lunch at Camberley's RadioQUK.com. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in the UK today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own many of the transmitters and printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or broadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters, the Illuminati banksters at Wewelsburg and Windsor Castle, get you down.